Chapter 5 The Grey King 1
You seem to be spending a great deal of our money very quickly, Lucas, said Doña Sofia Salvara.
Circumstance has blessed us, Doña Sofia. Locke gave a smile that was a measure of great triumph by Fairwhite standards, a tight-lipped little thing that might have been a grimace of pain from anyone else.
Everything is proceeding with the most agreeable speed. Ships and men and cargo, and soon all we'll need to do is pack your wardrobe for a short voyage.
Indeed, indeed.
Were those dark circles under her eyes? Was there the slightest hint of wariness in her attitude toward him? She certainly wasn't at ease. Locke made a mental note to avoid pushing her too far, too fast. It was a delicate dance, playing straight lines and smiles with someone who knew he was a mummer but didn't know that he knew she knew. With the slightest sigh, Doña Sofia pressed her personal sigil down into the warm blue wax at the bottom of the parchment she was contemplating. She added a few flowing lines of ink above the seal, her signature in the curving Therin script that had become something of a fad among literate nobles in the past few years.
"If you say you require another 4,000 today, another 4,000 it must be."
"I am most sincerely grateful, my lady."
"Well, you'll certainly pay for it soon enough," she said. "Many times over, if our hopes play out."
At that she smiled, with genuine good humour that crinkled the edges of her eyes, and held out the fresh promissory note. "Oho," thought Locke, "much better. The more in control the mark thinks they are, the more easily they respond to real control." Another one of Father Chain's old maxims, proven in Locke's experience too many times to count.
"Please give my warmest regards to your husband when he returns from his business in the city, my lady," said Locke, taking the wax-sealed parchment in hand. "Now, I fear, I must go see some men about payments that will not appear on any official ledger."
"Of course, I quite understand. Conte can show you out."
The gruff, weathered man-at-arms was paler than usual, and it seemed to Locke that there was a slight but obvious hitch in his stride. Yes, the poor fellow was clearly favouring a certain badly bruised portion of his anatomy. Locke's stomach turned in unconscious sympathy at his own memory of that night.
"I say, Conte," he began politely, "are you feeling quite well? You seem, forgive me for saying so, troubled this past day or two."
"I'm well for the most part, Master Fairwhite."
There was a slight hardening of the lines at the edges of the man's mouth.
"Perhaps a bit under the weather."
"Nothing serious?"
"A minor ague, perhaps. They happen this time of year."
"Ah, one of the tricks of your climate. I've not yet felt such a thing myself."
"Well,"
said Conte, with an absolute lack of expression on his face.
"Mind yourself, then, Master Fairwhite. Camor can be a very dangerous place in the most unlooked-for ways."
"Oh, ho, ho," Locke thought. So they'd let him in on the secret as well. And the man had a proud streak, at least as wide as Sophia's, to drop even the slightest hint of a threat. Worth noting, that.
"I'm the very soul of caution, my dear Conte."
Locke tucked the promissory note within his black waistcoat and adjusted his cascading cravats as they approached the front door of the Salvara Manor.
"I keep my chambers very well illuminated to ward off miasmas, and I wear copper rings after false light. Just the thing for your hot and cold fevers. I would wager that a few days at sea will put you right."
"No doubt," said Conte. "The voyage. I do look forward to the voyage."
"Then we are of one mind."
Locke waited for the Don's man to open the wide glass and iron door for him, and as he stepped out into the moist air of false light, he nodded stiffly but affably.
"I shall pray for your health tomorrow, my good fellow."
too kind, Master Fairwhite."
The ex-soldier had set one hand on the hilt of one of his knives, perhaps unconsciously.
"I shall most assuredly offer prayers concerning yours."
Locke began walking south at a leisurely pace, crossing from the Isla Durona to Two Silver Green, as he and Carlo had just a few nights previously. The hangman's wind was stronger than usual, and as he walked through the park in the washed-out light of the city's glowing elderglass, the hiss and rustle of leaves was like the sighing of vast creatures hiding in the greenery all around him. Just under 17,000 crowns in half a week. The Don Salvara game was well ahead of their original plans, which had called for a 2-week span between first touch and final blow-off. Locke was certain he could get one more touch out of the Don in perfect safety, push the total up over 22 or maybe 23,000, and then pull a vanish. Go to ground, take it easy for a few weeks, stay alert and let the Grey King mess sort itself out. And then, as a bonus miracle, somehow convince Kappa Barsavi to disengage him from Nazca, and do so without twisting the old man's breeches. Locke sighed. When false light died and true night fell, the glow never seemed to simply fade so much as recede, as though it were being drawn back within the glass, alone reclaimed by a jealous creditor. Shadows widened and blackened until finally the whole park was swallowed by them from below. Emerald lanterns flickered to life here and there in the trees, their light soft and eerie and strangely relaxing. They offered just enough illumination to see the crushed stone paths that wound their way through the walls of trees and hedges. Locke felt as though the spring of tension within him was unwinding itself ever so slightly. He listened to the muted crunch of his own footsteps on gravel, and for a few moments he was surprised to find himself possessed by something perilously close to contentment. He was alive. He was rich. He had made the decision not to skulk and cringe from the troubles that gnawed at his gentleman bastards. And for one brief moment, in the middle of 88,000 people and all the heaving, stinking, ever-flowing noise and commerce and machinery of their city, he was alone with the gently swaying trees of Two Silver Green. Alone. The hairs on the back of his neck stood up, and the old cold fear, the constant companion of anyone raised on the streets, was suddenly alive within him. It was a summer night in Two Silver Green, the safest open park in the city, patrolled at any given time by 2 or 3 squads of yellow jackets, with their night lanterns waving on poles. Filled, sometimes to the point of comedy, with the strolling sons and daughters of the wealthy classes, holding hands and swatting insects and seeking the privacy of nooks and shadows. Locke gazed quickly up and down the curving paths around him. He was truly alone. There was no sound in the park but for the sighing of the leaves and the buzzing of the insects. No voices or footsteps that he could hear. He twisted his right forearm, and a thin stiletto of blackened steel fell from his coat sleeve into his palm, pommel down. He carried it straight against his arm, rendering it invisible from any distance, and hurried toward the southern gate of the park. A mist was rising, seeping up as though the grass were pouring grey vapours into the night. Locke shivered despite the warm, heavy air. A mist was perfectly natural, wasn't it? The whole city was blanketed in the stuff 2 nights out of 3. A man could lose track of the end of his own nose in it sometimes, but why? The southern gate of the park. He was standing before the southern gate of the park, staring out across an empty cobbled lane at a mist-shrouded bridge. That bridge was the Eldrin Arch, its red lanterns soft and ominous in the fog. The Eldrin Arch leading north to the Isla Durona. He'd gotten turned around. How was that possible? His heart was beating so fast, and then Doña Sofia. That cunning bitch. She'd done something to him, slipped him some alchemical mischief on the parchment. The ink? The wax? Was it a poison, drawing some cloud around his senses before it did its work? Was it some other drug, intended to make him ill? Petty, perfectly deniable revenge to sate her for the time being? He fumbled for the parchment, missing his inner coat pocket, aware that he was moving a bit too slowly and clumsily for the confusion to be entirely in his imagination. There were men moving under the trees. One to his left, another to his right. The Eldrin Arch was gone. He was back at the heart of the curving paths, staring out into a darkness cut only by the emerald light of the lanterns. He gasped, crouched, brought up the stiletto, head swimming. The men were cloaked. They were on either side. There was the sound of footsteps on gravel, not his own. The dark shape of crossbows, the backlit shapes of the men. His head whirled.
"Master Thorne," said a man's voice, muffled and distant. "We require an hour of your attention."
"Crooked Warden!" Locke gasped, and then even the faint colours of the trees seemed to drain from his vision, and the whole night went black. 3. When he came to, he was already sitting up. It was a curious sensation. He'd awoken before from blackness brought on by injuries and by drugs, but this was different. It was as though someone had simply set the mechanisms of his consciousness moving again, like a scholar opening the spigot on a Ferrari water clock. He was in the common room of a tavern, seated on a chair at a table by himself. He could see the bar and the hearth and the other tables, but the place was dank and empty, smelling of mould and dust. A flickering orange light came from behind him, an oil lantern. The windows were greasy and misted over, turning the light back upon itself. He couldn't see anything of the outside through them.
"There's a crossbow at your back," said a voice just a few feet behind him, a pleasantly cultured man's voice, definitely Komori, but somewhat off in a few of the pronunciations. A native who'd spent time elsewhere? The voice was entirely unknown to him.
"Master Thorne."
Icicles seemed to grow in Locke's spine. He racked his brains furiously for recall of those last few seconds in the park. Hadn't one of the men there called him that as well? He gulped.
"Why do you call me that? My name is Lucas Fairwhite. I'm a citizen of Emberlane, working for the House of Bel Oster." "I could believe that, Master Thorne. Your accent is convincing, and your willingness to suffer that black wool is nothing short of heroic. Don Lorenzo and Doña Sofia certainly believed in Lucas Fairwhite, until you yourself disabused them of the notion."
"It isn't Barsavi," Locke thought desperately. "It couldn't be Barsavi. Barsavi would be conducting this conversation himself, if he knew. He would be conducting it at the heart of the floating grave, with every gentleman bastard tied to a post and every knife in Sage Kindness' bag sharpened and gleaming.
"My name is Lucas Fairwhite," Locke insisted. "I don't understand what you want or what I'm doing here. Have you done anything to Grauman? Is he safe?"
"Jean Tannen is perfectly safe," said the man, "as you well know. How I would have loved to see it up close, when you strolled into Don Salvara's office with that silly sigil wallet under your black cloak, destroying his confidence in Lucas Fairwhite, just as a father gently tells his children there's really no such thing as the Blessed Bringer. You're an artist, Master Thorne."
"I've already told you my name is Lucas, Lucas Fairwhite, and..."
"If you tell me that your name is Lucas Fairwhite one more time, I'm going to put a bolt through the back of your upper left arm. I wouldn't mean to kill you, just to complicate your life. A nice big hole, maybe a broken bone. Ruin that fine suit of yours, perhaps get blood all over that lovely parchment. Wouldn't the clerks at Maraggio's love to hear an explanation for that? Promissory notes are so much more attention-getting when they're covered in gore."
Locke said nothing for quite a long while. "Now that won't do either, Locke. Surely you must have realized I can't be one of Barsavi's men."
13, Locke thought. Where the hell did I make a mistake? If the man was speaking truthfully, if he didn't work for Kappa Barsavi, there was only one other possibility. The real Spider. The real Midnighters. Had Locke's use of the pretend sigil wallet been reported? Had that counterfeiter in Talisham decided to try for a bit of extra profit by dropping a word with the Duke's secret constables? It seemed the likeliest explanation.
"Turn around. Slowly."
Locke stood up and did so, and bit his tongue to avoid crying out in surprise. The man seated at the table before him could have been anywhere between 30 and 50. He was lean and rangy and grey at the temples. The mark of Camor was upon his face. He bore the sun-darkened olive skin, the high temples and cheekbones, the sharp nose. He wore a grey leather doublet over a grey silk tunic. His cloak and mantle were grey, as was the hood that was swept back behind his head. His hands, folded neatly before him, were covered with thin grey swordsman's gloves, kid leather that was weathered and creased with use. The man had hunter's eyes, cold and steady and measuring. The orange light of the lantern was reflected in their dark pupils. For a second it seemed to Locke that he was seeing not a reflection but a revelation, that the dark fire burned behind the man's eyes. Locke shivered despite himself. All that grey.
"You,"
he whispered, dropping the accent of Lucas Fairwhite.
"None other," said the Grey King. "I disdain these clothes as something of a theatrical touch, but it's a necessary one. Of all the men in Camor, surely you understand these things, Master Thorn."
"I have no idea why you keep calling me that," said Locke, shifting his footing as unobtrusively as he could, feeling the comforting weight of his second stiletto in the other sleeve of his coat. "And I don't see this crossbow you mentioned."
"I said it was at your back."
The Grey King gestured at the far wall with a thin, bemused smile. Warily, Locke turned his head. There was a man standing against the wall of the tavern, standing right in the spot Locke had been staring at until the previous moment. A cloaked and hooded man, broad-shouldered, leaning lazily against the wall with a loaded alley-piece in the crook of his arm, the quarrel pointed casually at Locke's chest. Locke turned back, but the Grey King was no longer seated at the table. He was standing a dozen feet away, to Locke's left, behind the disused bar. The lantern on the table hadn't moved, and Locke could see that the man was grinning.
"This isn't possible."
"Of course it is, Master Thorn. Think it through. The number of possibilities is actually vanishingly small."
The Grey King waved his left hand in an arc, as though wiping a window. Locke glanced back at the wall and saw that the crossbowman had disappeared once again.
"Well, fuck me," said Locke. "You're a bondsmage."
"No," said the Grey King. "I'm a man without that advantage. No different than yourself. But I employ a bondsmage."
He pointed to the table where he'd previously been sitting. There, without any sudden movement or jump in Locke's perception, sat a slender man, surely not yet out of his 20s. His chin and cheeks were peach-fuzzed, and his hairline was already in rapid retreat to the back of his head. His eyes were alight with amusement, and Locke immediately saw in him the sort of casual presumption of authority that most congenital blue-bloods wore like a second skin. He was dressed in an extremely well-tailored grey coat with flaring red silk cuffs. The bare skin of his left wrist bore 3 tattooed black lines. On his right hand was a heavy leather gauntlet, and perched atop this, staring at Locke as though he were nothing more than a field mouse with delusions of grandeur, was the fiercest hunting hawk Locke had ever seen.
The bird of prey stared directly at him, its eyes pinpoints of black within gold on either side of a curved beak that looked dagger-sharp. Its brown and grey wings were folded back sleekly, and its talons... What was wrong with its talons? Its rear claws were huge, distended, oddly lengthened.
"My associate, the Falconer," said the Grey King, "a bondsmage of Carthane, my bondsmage, the key to a great many things. And now that we've been introduced, let us speak of what I expect you to do for me."
4. "They are not to be fucked with," Chains had told him once, many years before.
"Why not?"
Locke was 12 or 13 at the time, about as cocksure as he'd ever been in life, which was saying something.
"I see you've been neglecting your history again. I'll assign you more reading shortly."
Chains sighed.
"The Bonds Magi of Carthane are the only sorcerers on the continent because they permit no one else to study their art. Outsiders they find must join them or be slain."
"And none resist? Nobody fights back or hides from them?"
"Of course they do, here and there. But what can 2 or 5 or 10 sorcerers in hiding do against 400 with a city-state at their command? What the Bonds Magi do to outsiders and renegades, they make Kappa Barsavi look like a priest of Perelandro. They are utterly jealous, utterly ruthless, and utterly without competition. They have achieved their desired monopoly. No one will shelter sorcerers against the will of the Bonds Magi. No one. Not even the King of the Seven Marrows."
"Curious," said Locke, "that they would still call themselves Bonds Magi then."
"It's false modesty. I think it amuses them. They set such ridiculous prices for their services, it's less like mercenary work to them and more like a cruel joke at the expense of their clients."
"Ridiculous prices?"
"A novice would cost you 500 crowns a day. A more experienced spellbinder might cost you 1,000. They mark their rank with tattoos around their wrists. The more black circles you see, the more polite you become."
1,000 crowns a day?
"You see now why they're not everywhere, on retainer to every court and noble and pissant warlord with a treasury to waste. Even in times of war and other extreme crises, they can be secured for a very limited duration. When you do cross paths with one, you can be sure that the client is paying them for serious, active work."
"Where did they come from?"
"Carthane."
"Ha ha! I mean their guild, their monopoly."
"That's easy. One night a powerful sorcerer knocks on the door of a less powerful sorcerer. 'I'm starting an exclusive guild,' he says. 'Join me now or I'll blast you out of your fucking boots right where you stand.' So naturally the second mage says,
'You know, I've always wanted to join a guild.'
'Right. Those two go bother a third sorcerer. 'Join the guild,' they say, 'or fight both of us, 2-on-1, right here and right now.' Repeat as necessary until 300 or 400 guild members are knocking on the door of the last independent mage around, and everyone who said no is dead."
"They must have weaknesses," said Locke.
"Of course they've got weaknesses, boy. They're mortal men and women, same as us. They eat, they shit, they age, they die. But they're like God's damned hornets. Mess with one and the rest show up to punch you full of holes. 13 help anyone who kills a bondsmage, purposely or otherwise."
"Why?"
"It's the oldest rule of their guild. A rule without exceptions.
Kill a bonds mage and the whole guild drops whatever it's doing to come after you. They seek you out by any means they need to use. They kill your friends, your family, your associates. They burn your home. They destroy everything you've ever built. Before they finally let you die, they make sure you know that your line has been wiped from the earth, root and branch.
So nobody's allowed to oppose them at all?
Oh, you can oppose them all right. You can try to fight back, for what it's worth when one of them is against you. But if you go as far as killing one, well, it's just not worth it. Suicide would be preferable. At least then they won't kill everyone you ever loved or befriended.
Wow.
Yes. Chains shook his head. Sorcery's impressive enough, but it's their fucking attitude that makes them such a pain. And that's why, when you find yourself face to face with one, you bow and scrape and mind your sirs and madams.
5. Nice bird, arsehole, said Locke.
The bondsmage stared coldly at him, nonplussed.
So you must be the reason nobody can find your boss. The reason none of the full crowns could remember what they were doing when tall Tesso got nailed to a wall.
The falcon screeched, and Locke flinched backward. The creature's anger was extremely expressive. It was more than the cry of an agitated animal. It was somehow personal. Locke raised his eyebrows.
My familiar mislikes your tone of voice, said the falconer. I, for one, have always found her judgment to be impeccable. I would mind your tongue.
Your boss expects me to do something for him, said Locke, which means I have to remain functional. Which means the manner in which I address his fucking Carthani lackeys is immaterial. Some of the garistas you killed were friends of mine. I'm looking at an arranged fucking marriage because of you, so eat hemp and shit rope, bondsmage. The falcon exploded, screeching, from its perch on its master's hand. Locke raised his left arm in front of his face, and the bird slammed against it, talons clutching with edges that sliced through the fabric of Locke's coat sleeve. The bird fastened itself on Locke's arm excruciatingly and beat its wings to steady itself. Locke hollered and raised his right hand to punch the bird.
"Do that," said the falconer, "and die. Look closely at my familiar's talons."
Biting the insides of his cheeks against the pain, Locke did just that. The creature's rear talons weren't talons at all, but more like smooth, curved hooks that narrowed to needle points at their tips. There were strange, pulsating sacs on the legs just above them, and even to Locke's limited knowledge of hunting birds, this seemed very wrong.
"Vestris," said the Grey King, "is a scorpion hawk, a hybrid, facilitated by alchemy and sorcery. One of many that the bonds magi amuse themselves with. She carries not just talons, but a sting. If she were to cease being tolerant of you, you might make it 10 steps before you fell dead in your tracks."
Blood began to drip from Locke's arm. He groaned. The bird snapped at him with its beak, clearly enjoying itself.
"Now," said the Grey King, "are we not all grown men and birds here? Functional is such a relative state of affairs, Locke. I would hate to have to give you another demonstration of just how relative."
"I apologize," said Locke between gritted teeth. "Vestris is a fine and persuasive little bird."
The falconer said nothing, but Vestris released her grip on Locke's left arm, unleashing new spikes of pain. Locke clutched his bloodied wool sleeve, massaging the wounds within it. Vestris fluttered back to her perch on her master's glove and resumed staring at Locke.
"Isn't it just as I said, falconer?"
The Grey King beamed at Locke.
"Our thorn knows how to recover his equilibrium. 2 minutes ago he was too scared to think.
Now he's already insulting us and no doubt scheming for a way out of this situation.
I don't understand, said Locke, why you keep calling me Thorn.
Of course you do, said the Grey King. I'm only going to go over this once, Locke. I know about your little burrow beneath the House of Perelandro, your vault, your fortune. I know you don't spend any of your nights sneak thieving, as you claim to all the other right people. I know you breach the secret peace to spring elaborate confidence schemes on nobles who don't know any better, and I know you're good at it. I know you didn't start these ridiculous rumours about the Thorn of Camor, but you and I both know they refer to your exploits indirectly. Lastly, I understand that Kappa Barsavi would do some very interesting things to you and all of your gentleman bastards if the things I know were to be confided to him.
Oh, please, said Locke. You're not exactly in any position to whisper politely in his ear and be taken seriously.
I'm not the one who would be whispering in his ear, said the Grey King, smiling. If you failed at the task I have for you, I have others close to him to speak for me. I trust I have made myself very clear.
Locke glared for a few seconds, then sat down with a sigh, turning his chair around and leaning his injured arm against the back.
I see your point. And in exchange?
In exchange for the task I require, I would promise you that Kappa Barsavi won't hear about your very cleverly arranged double life, nor that of your closest companions.
So, said Locke slowly, that's how it is.
My bondsmage accepted, I'm a thrifty man, Locke.
The Grey King stepped out from behind the bar and folded his arms.
You get paid in life, not coin.
What's the task?
A straightforward beguilement, said the Grey King. I want you to become me.
I don't understand.
The time has come for me to quit this game of shadows. Barsavi and I need to speak face to face. I will very shortly arrange a clandestine conference with the Kappa, one that will bring him forth from the floating grave.
Fat chance.
In this you must trust me. I'm the architect of his current troubles. I assure you, I know what can bring him out from that soggy fortress of his. But it won't be me that he'll speak to. It will be you, the Thorn of Camor, the greatest mummer this city has ever produced. You, cast in the role of me, just for one night, a virtuoso performance.
A command performance? Why?
I will be required elsewhere at that time. The conference is one part of a wider concern.
I am personally known to Kappa Barsavi and his entire family.
You have already convinced the Salvaras that you were two different men. In the same day, no less. I'll coach you in what I wish you to say, and provide you with a suitable wardrobe. Between your skills and my current anonymity, no one will ever be aware that you are even involved, or that you are not the real Grey King.
An amusing plan. It has balls, and that appeals to me. But you do realize that I'm going to look like quite the ass, said Locke, when the Kappa opens our conversation with a dozen crossbow bolts to my chest.
Hardly an issue. You'll be quite well protected against routine foolishness on the Kappa's part. I'll be sending the falconer with you.
Locke flicked his gaze back to the bondsmage, who smiled with obvious mock magnanimity.
Do you really think, continued the Grey King, that I would have let you keep that other stiletto in your coat sleeve if any weapon in your hands could touch me? Try to cut me. I'll let you borrow a crossbow or two if you like. A quarrel will do no better. The same protection will be yours when you meet with the copper.
Then it's true, said Locke. Those stories aren't just stories. Your pet mage gives you more than just the ability to make my brain lock up like I've been drinking all night.
Yes, and it was my men who started spreading those stories for one purpose. I wanted Barsavi's gangs to so dread my presence that they wouldn't dare to get close to you when the time came for you to speak to him. After all, I have the power to kill men with a touch.
The Grey King smiled.
And when you're me, so will you.
Locke frowned. That smile, that face, there was something damned familiar about the Grey King. Nothing immediately obvious, just a nagging sensation that Locke had been in his presence before. He cleared his throat.
That's very thoughtful of you. And what happens when I've finished this task for you?
A parting of the ways, said the Grey King. You to your business and me to my own.
I find that somewhat difficult to believe.
You'll leave your meeting with Barsavi alive, Locke. Fear not for what happens after that. I assure you it won't be as bad as you think. If I merely wanted to assassinate him, can you deny that I could have done it long ago?
You've killed 7 of his garistas. You've kept him locked away on the floating grave for months.
Not as bad as I think. He killed 8 of his own full crowns after Tesso died. He won't accept less than blood from you.
Barsavi has kept himself locked away on the floating grave, Locke. And as I said, you must trust me to deal with that end of the situation. The copper will acquiesce to what I have to offer him. We'll settle the question of Camor once and for all, to everyone's satisfaction.
I grant that you're dangerous, said Locke, but you must be mad.
Suit whatever meaning you wish to my actions, Locke, provided that you perform as required.
It would appear, Locke said sourly, that I have no choice.
This is no accident. Are we agreed? You'll perform this task for me?
With instruction in what you wish me to say to Copper Barsavi?
Yes. There will be one other condition.
Really? If I'm going to do this for you, said Locke, I need to have a way to speak to you, or at least get a message to you at my own will. Something may come up which can't wait for you to prance around appearing out of nowhere.
It's unlikely, said the Grey King.
It's a necessity. Do you want me to be successful in this task or not?
Very well, the Grey King nodded. Falconer.
The falconer rose from his seat. Vestris never took her eyes from Locke's. The hawk's master reached inside his coat with his free hand and withdrew a candle, a tiny cylinder of white wax with an odd smear of crimson swirling through it.
"Light this," said the bondsmage, "in a place of solitude. You must be absolutely alone. Speak my name, and I will hear and come soon enough."
"Thank you."
Locke took the candle with his right hand and slipped it into his own coat. Falconer. Easy to remember, that. Vestris opened her beak, but made no noise. It snapped shut, and the bird blinked. A yawn? Her version of a chuckle at Locke's expense?
"I'll be keeping an eye on you," said the bondsmage. "Just as Vestris feels what I feel, I see what she sees."
"That explains quite a bit," said Locke.
"If we are agreed," said the Grey King, "our business here is finished. I have something else to do, and it must be done tonight. Thank you, Master Thorn, for seeing reason."
said the man with the crossbow to the man with the money purse. Locke stood up and slipped his left hand into a coat pocket. The forearm was still throbbing with pain.
So when is this meeting supposed to take place?
3 nights hence, said the Grey King. No interruption at all for your Don Salvara game, I trust.
I don't think you really care, but no.
All for the better, then. Let us return you to your own affairs.
You're not going to...
But it was too late. The falconer had already begun to gesture with his free hand and move his lips, forming words but not quite vocalizing them. The room spun. The orange lantern light became a fading streak of color against the darkness of the room, and then there was only darkness. 6.
When Locke's senses returned, he found himself standing on the bridge between the snare and Coin Kisser's Row. Not a moment had passed, by his own personal reckoning, but when he looked up he saw that the clouds were gone, the stars had whirled in the dark sky, and the moons were low in the west.
"Son of a bitch!" he hissed. "It's been hours! Jean's going to be having fits!"
He thought quickly. Carlo and Galdo had planned to spend the evening making their rounds in the snare, with Bug in tow. They would probably have ended up at the last mistake, dicing and drinking and trying not to get thrown out for card sharping. Jean had intended to spend the night feigning occupancy in the broken tower rooms, at least until Locke returned. That would be the closest place to begin hunting for them. Just then Locke remembered that he was still dressed as Lucas Fairwhite. He slapped his forehead. He pulled his coat and cravats off, yanked the false optics from the bridge of his nose, and stuffed them in a vest pocket. He gingerly felt the cuts on his left arm. They were deep and still painful, but the blood had crusted on them, so at least he wasn't dripping all over the place. "God's damn the Grey King," thought Locke, "and God's grant I get the chance to balance this night out in the ledger." He ruffled his hair, unbuttoned his vest, untucked his shirt, and reached down to fold and conceal the ridiculous ribbon tongues of his shoes. His cravats and his decorative belts went into the coat, which Locke then folded up and tied by the sleeves. In the darkness it bore an excellent resemblance to a plain old cloth sack. With the outward flourishes of Lucas Fairwhite broken down, he could at least pass without notice for a reasonably short period of time. Satisfied, he turned and began to walk quickly down the south side of the bridge, toward the still lively lights and noises of the snare. Jean Tannen actually appeared from an alley and took him by the arm as he turned onto the street on the north side of the broken tower, where the main entrance to the last mistake opened onto the cobbles.
"Locke, where the hell have you been all night? Are you well?"
"Jean, gods, am I ever glad to see you! I'm far from well, as are you. Where are the others?"
"When you didn't return," Jean said, speaking in a low voice close to Locke's ear, "I found them in the last mistake and sent them up to our rooms with Bug. I've been pacing the alleys down here, trying to keep out of sight. I didn't want us all getting scattered across the city by night. We feared..."
"I was taken, Jean, but then I was let go. Let's get up to the rooms. We have a new problem, fresh from the oven and hot as hell."
7. They let the windows in their rooms stay open this time, with thin sheets of translucent mesh drawn down to keep out biting insects. The sky was turning grey, with lines of red visible just beneath the eastern windowsills, when Locke finished relating the events of the night. His listeners had shadows beneath their bleary eyes, but none showed any indication of sleepiness just then.
"At least we know now," Locke finished, "that he won't be trying to kill me like he did the other Garistas."
"Not until 3 nights hence, anyway," said Galdo.
"Bastards simply can't be trusted," said Bug.
"But for the time being," said Locke, "he must be obeyed."
Locke had changed into spare clothes. He now looked much more suitably low class. Jean had insisted on washing his arm with reinforced wine, heated to near boiling on an alchemical hearthstone. Locke now had a compress of brandy-soaked cloth pressed to it, and he bathed it in the light of a small white glow-globe. It was common knowledge among the physicists of Camor that light drove back malodorous air and helped prevent lingering infections.
"Must he?" Carlo scratched a stubbly chin. "How far do you figure we can get if we run like hell?"
"From the Grey King? Who knows?" Locke sighed. "From the Bondsmage, not far enough, ever." "So we just sit back," said Jean, "and let him pull your strings like a marionette on stage."
"I was rather taken," said Locke, "with the whole idea of him not telling Kappa Barsavi about our confidence games, yes." "This whole thing is mad," said Galdo. "You said you saw three rings on this falconer's wrist?"
"The one that didn't have the damn scorpion hawk, yeah."
"Three rings," Jean muttered. "It is mad. To keep one of those people in service. It must be 2 months now since the first stories of the Grey King appeared, since the first Garista got it. Who was it again?"
"Gil the Cutter from the Rumhounds," said Carlo.
"The coin involved has to be ludicrous. I doubt the Duke could keep a bondsmage of rank on for this long. So who the fuck is this Grey King, and how is he paying for this?"
"Immaterial," said Locke. "3 nights hence, or 2.5 now that the sun's coming up, there'll be 2 Grey Kings, and I'll be one of them."
13, said Jean. He put his head in his hands and rubbed his eyes with his palms.
"So that's the bad news. Kappa Barsavi wants me to marry his daughter, and now the Grey King wants me to impersonate him at a secret meeting with Kappa Barsavi."
Locke grinned.
"The good news is I didn't get any blood on that new promissory note for 4,000 crowns."
"I'll kill him," said Bug. "Get me poisoned quarrels and an alley piece, and I'll drill him in the eyes."
"Bug," said Locke, "that makes leaping off a temple roof sound reasonable by comparison."
"But who would ever expect it?"
Bug, sitting beneath one of the room's eastern windows, turned his head to stare out it for a few moments, as he had been intermittently doing all night.
"Look, everyone knows that one of you four could kill them, but nobody would expect me. Total surprise. One shot in the face, no more Grey King."
"Assuming the falconer allowed your crossbow bolts to hit his client," said Locke, "he would probably cook us where we stood right after that. Also, I very much doubt that fucking bird is going to be fluttering around this tower where we can see it."
"You never know," said Bug. "I think I saw it before, when we made first touch on Don Salvara."
"I'm pretty sure I did, too."
Carlo was knuckle-walking a Solon on his left hand without looking at it.
"While I was strangling you, Locke, something flew overhead. Damn big and fast for a wren or a sparrow."
"So," said Jean, "he really has been watching us, and he really knows all there is to know about us. Knuckling under might be wiser for the time being, but we've got to have some contingencies we can cook up."
"Should we call off the Don Salvara game now?"
asked Bug meekly. "No." Locke shook his head vigorously. "There's absolutely no reason for the time being."
"How," said Galdo, "do you figure that?"
"The reason we discussed shortening the game was to keep our heads down and try to avoid getting killed by the Grey King. Now we can be pretty damn sure that won't happen, at least not for 3 days. So the Salvara game stays in play."
"For 3 days, yes, until the Grey King has no further use for you."
Jean spat. "Next step in whatever the plans are. Thanks for your cooperation. Here's a complimentary knife in the back for all of you." "It's a possibility," said Locke. "So what we do is this. Jean, you scuttle around today after you've had some sleep. Cancel those arrangements for sea travel. If we need to run, waiting for a ship to put out will take too long. Likewise, drop more gold at the Viscount's gate. If we go out, we go out by land. And I want that gate swinging wider and faster than a whorehouse door. Carlo, Galdo, you find us a wagon. Stash it behind the temple. Set it up with tarps and rope for fast packing.
Get us food and drink for the road. Simple stuff, sturdy stuff. Spare cloaks, plain clothing. You know what to do. If any right people spot you at work, maybe drop a hint that we're after a fat score in the next few days. Barsavi would like that, if it gets back to him. Bug, tomorrow you and I are going to go through the vault. We'll bring up every coin in there, and we're going to pack them in canvas sacks for easy transport. If we have to run, I want to be able to throw the whole mess on the back of our wagon in just a few minutes.
Makes sense, said Bug.
So, Sunsers, you stick together, said Locke. Bug, you're with me. Nobody goes it alone for any length of time except Jean. You're the least likely to get troubled if the Grey King's got anything less than an army hidden in the city. Oh, you know me. Jean reached behind his neck, down behind the loose leather vest he wore over his simple cotton tunic. He withdrew a pair of matching hatchets, each a foot and a half in length, with leather-wrapped handles and straight black blades that narrowed like scalpels. These were balanced with balls of blackened steel, each as wide around as a silver solon. The Wicked Sisters, Jean's weapons of choice. I never travel alone. It's always the three of us. Right then, Locke yawned. If we need any other bright ideas, we can conjure them when we wake up. Let's set something heavy against the door, shut the windows, and start snoring. The gentleman bastards had just stumbled to their feet to begin putting this sensible plan into action when Jean held up one hand for silence. The stairs outside the door on the north wall of the chamber were creaking under the weight of many feet. A moment later, someone was banging on the door itself.
Lamora! Came a loud male voice. Open up! Copper's business!
Jean slipped his hatchets into one hand and put that hand behind his back, then stood against the north wall, a few feet to the right of the door. Carlo and Galdo reached under their shirts for their daggers, Galdo pushing Bug back behind him as they did so. Locke stood in the centre of the room, remembering that his stilettos were still wrapped up in his fair white coat.
"What's the price of a loaf?" he shouted. "At the shifting market!"
"One copper flat, but the loaves ain't dry," came the response.
Locke untensed just a bit. That was this week's proper greeting and countersign, and if they'd been coming to haul him off for anything bloody, well, they'd have simply kicked in the door. Signalling with his hands for everyone to stay calm, he drew out the bolt and slid the front door open just wide enough to peek out. There were four men on the platform outside his door, 70 feet in the air above the last mistake. The sky was the colour of murky canal water behind them, with just a few twinkling stars vanishing slowly here and there. They were hard-looking men, standing ready and easy like trained fighters, wearing leather tunics, leather collars, and red cloth bandanas under black leather caps. Red Hands, the gang Barsavi turned to when he needed muscle work, and he needed it fast.
"Begging your pardon, brother,"
the apparent leader of the Red Hands put one arm up against the door.
"Big man wants to see Locke Lamora right this very moment, and he don't care what state he's in, and he won't let us take no for an answer."
Interlude. Jean Tannen. 1. In the year that followed, Locke grew, but not as much as he would have liked. Although it was difficult to guess his true age with any hope of accuracy, it was obvious that he was more than a little runty for it.
"You missed a few meals in your very early years," Chains told him. "You've done much better since you came here, to be sure, but I suspect you'll always be a bit on the medium side."
"Always."
"Don't be too upset."
Chains put his hands on his own round belly and chuckled.
"A little man can slip out of a pinch that a greater man might find inescapable."
There was further schooling, more sums, more history, more maps, more languages. Once Locke and the Sanzas had a firm grasp of conversational Vardran, Chains began having them instructed in the art of accents.
A few hours each week were spent in the company of an old Vardran sailmender who would chide them for their fumble-mouthed mangling of the northern tongue while he drove his long, wicked needles through yard upon yard of folded canvas. They would chat about any subject on the old man's mind, and he would fastidiously correct every consonant that was too short and every vowel that was too long. He would also get steadily more red-faced and belligerent as each session went on, for chains paid him in wine for his services. There were trials, some trivial and some quite harsh. Chains tested his boys constantly, almost ruthlessly, but when he was finished with each new conundrum, he always took them to the temple roof to explain what he'd wanted, what the hardship signified. His openness after the fact made his games easier to bear, and they had the added effect of uniting Locke, Carlo, and Galdo against the world around them. The more chains tightened the screws, the closer the boys grew, the more smoothly they worked together, the less they had to say out loud to set a plan in motion. The coming of Jean Tannen changed all that. It was the month of Saris in the 77th year of Yono, the end of an unusually dry and cool autumn. Storms had lashed the iron sea, but spared Camor by some trick of the winds or the gods, and the nights were finer than any in Locke's living memory. He was sitting the steps with Father Chains, flexing his fingers, eagerly awaiting the rise of false light, when he spotted the thief-maker walking across the square toward the house of Perelandro. 2 years had removed some of the dread Locke had once felt toward his former master, but there was no denying that the skinny old fellow retained a certain grotesque magnetism. The thief-maker's spindly fingers spread as he bowed from the waist, and his eyes lit up when they seized on Locke.
"My dear bedeviling little boy, what a pleasure it is to see you leading a productive life in the Order of Perelandro.
He owes his success to your early discipline, of course." Chain's smile spread beneath his blindfold. "It's what helped to make him the resolute and morally upright youth he is today."
"Upright?"
The thief-maker squinted at Locke, feigning concentration.
"I'd be hard-pressed to say he's grown an inch. But no matter. I've brought you the boy we discussed, the one from the north corner. Step forward, Jean. You can't hide behind me any more than you could hide under a copper coin."
There was indeed a boy standing behind the thief-maker. When the old man shooed him out into plain view, Locke saw that he was about his own age, perhaps 10, and in every other respect his opposite. The new boy was fat, red-faced, shaped like a dirty pear with a greasy mop of black hair atop his head. His eyes were wide and shocked. He clenched and unclenched his soft hands nervously.
"Ah," said Chains. "Ah. I can't see him, but then the qualities the Lord of the Overlooked desires in his servants cannot be seen by any man. Are you penitent, my boy? Are you sincere? Are you as upright as those our charitable celestial master has already taken into his fold?"
He gave Locke a pat on the back, manacles and chains rattling. Locke, for his part, stared at the newcomer and said nothing.
"I hope so, sir," said Jean, in a voice that was soft and haunted.
"Well," said the thief-maker, "hope is what we all build lives for ourselves upon, is it not? The good Father Chains is your master now, boy. I leave you to his care."
"Not mine, but that of the higher power I serve," said Chains. "Oh, before you leave, I just happened to find this purse sitting on my temple steps earlier today."
He held out a fat little leather bag stuffed with coins and waved it in the thief-maker's general direction.
"Is it yours, by chance?"
"Why, so it is, so it is."
The thief-maker plucked the purse from Chain's hands and made it vanish into the pockets of his weather-eaten coat.
What a fortunate coincidence that is!
He bowed once more, turned, and began to walk back in the direction of Shades Hill, whistling tunelessly. Chains arose, rubbed his legs, and clapped his hands.
Let us call an end to our public duties for the day. Jean, this is Locke Lamora, one of my initiates. Please help him carry this kettle into the sanctuary. Careful, it's heavy.
The thin boy and the fat boy heaved the kettle up the steps and into the damp sanctuary. The eyeless priest groped along his chains, gathering the slack and dragging it with him until he was safely inside. Locke worked the wall mechanism to slide the temple doors shut, and Chains settled himself down in the middle of the sanctuary floor.
"The kindly gentleman," said Chains, "who delivered you into my care, said that you could speak, read, and write in three languages."
"Yes, sir," said Jean, gazing around him in trepidation. "Therin, Vadran, and Isavrai."
"Very good. And you can do complex sums? Ledger balancing?"
"Yes."
"Excellent. Then you can help me count the day's takings. But first, come over here and give me your hand. That's it. Let us see if you have any of the gifts necessary to become an initiate of this temple, Jean Tannen."
What must I do?"
"Simply place your hands on my blindfold. No, stand easy. Close your eyes. Concentrate. Let whatever virtuous thoughts you have within you bubble to the surface."
2.
"I don't like him," said Locke. "I don't like him at all."
He and Chains were preparing the breakfast meal early the next morning. Locke was simmering up a soup from sliced onions and irregular little brown cubes of reduced beef stock, while Chains was attempting to crack the wax seal on a honey crock. His bare fingers and nails having failed, he was hacking at it with a stiletto and muttering to himself.
"Don't like him at all?"
"That's rather silly," said Chains, his voice distant, "since he's not yet been here a single day." "He's fat. He's soft. He's not one of us."
"He most certainly is. We showed him the temple and the burrow. He took oath as my pezon. I'll go see the copper with him in just a day or two."
"I don't mean one of us, gentlemen bastards. I mean one of us, us. He's not a thief. He's a soft, fat..."
"Merchant. Son of merchant parents is what he is. But he's a thief now."
"He didn't steal things. He didn't charm or tease. He said he was in the hill for a few days before he got brought here. So he's not one of us."
"Locke."
Chains turned from the business of the honeycrock and stared down at him, frowning.
"Jean Tannen is a thief because I'm going to train him as a thief. You do recall that's what I train here, thieves of a very particular sort. This hasn't slipped your mind?"
"But he's..."
"He's better learned than any of you. Scribes in a clean, smooth hand. Understands business, ledgers, money shifts, and a great many other things. Your former master knew I'd want him right away."
"He's fat."
"So am I. And you're ugly. Carlo and Galdo have noses like siege engines. Sabatha had spots breaking out last we saw her. Did you have a point?"
"He kept us up all night. He was crying, and he wouldn't shut up."
"I'm sorry," said a soft voice from behind them. Locke and Chains turned, the latter much more slowly than the former. Jean Tannen was standing by the door to the sleeping quarters, red-eyed.
"I didn't mean to. I couldn't help it."
"Ha!"
Chains turned back to his stiletto and his honeycrock. "Looks as though boys who live in glass burrows shouldn't speak so loudly of those in the next room."
"Well, don't do it again, Jean,"
said Locke, hopping down from the wooden step he still used to reach the top of the cooking hearth.
He crossed to one of the spice cabinets and began shuffling jars, looking for something.
"Shut up and let us sleep. Carlo and Galdo and I don't blubber."
"I'm sorry," said Jean, sounding close to tears again. "I'm sorry, it's just my mother, my father, I'm an orphan."
"So what?"
Locke took down a little glass bottle of pickled radishes, sealed with a stone stopper like an alchemical potion.
"I'm an orphan. We're all orphans here. Whining won't make your family live again."
Locke turned and took two steps back toward the cooking hearth, so he didn't see Jean cross the space between them. He did feel Jean's arm wrap around his neck from behind. It might have been soft, but it was damned heavy for a 10-year-old. Locke lost his grip on the pickled radishes. Jean picked him off the ground by main force, whirled and heaved him. Locke's feet left the ground at the same time the radish jar shattered against it. A confused second later, the back of Locke's head bounced off the heavy witchwood dining table, and he fell to the ground, landing painfully on his rather bony posterior.
"You shut up!"
There was nothing subdued about Jean now. He was screaming, red-faced, with tears pouring out of his eyes.
"You shut your filthy mouth! You never talk about my family!"
Locke put up his hands and tried to stand up. One of Jean's fists grew in his field of vision until it seemed to blot out half the world. The blow folded him over like a bread pretzel. When he recovered something resembling his senses, he was hugging a table leg. The room was dancing a minuet around him. He said, his mouth full of blood and pain.
"Now, Jean," said Chains, pulling the heavy-set boy away from Locke, "I think your message is rather thoroughly delivered."
"Oh, that really hurt," said Locke.
"It's only fair."
Chains released Jean, who balled his fists and stood glaring at Locke, shuddering.
"You really deserved it."
What?
"Sure, we're all orphans here. My parents were long dead before you were even born. Your parents are years gone. Same for Carlo and Galdo and Sabatha. But Jean," said Chains, "lost his only 5 nights ago."
"Oh,"
Locke sat up, groaning.
I didn't know."
"Well, then."
Chains finally succeeded in prying open the honeycrock. The wax seals split with an audible crack.
"When you don't know everything you could know, it's a fine time to shut your fucking noisemaker and be polite."
"It was a fire."
Jean took a few deep breaths, still staring at Locke.
"They burned to death. The whole shop. Everything gone."
He turned and walked back to the sleeping quarters, head down, rubbing at his eyes. Chains turned his back on Locke and began stirring the honey, breaking up the little patches of crystallization. There was an echoing clang from the fall of the secret door that led down from the temple above. A moment later, Carlo and Galdo appeared in the kitchen, each twin dressed in his white initiate's robe, each one balancing a long, soft loaf of bread atop his head.
"We have returned," said Carlo. "With bread, which is obvious." "No, you're obvious."
The twins stopped short when they saw Locke pulling himself up by the edge of the table, lips swollen, blood trickling from the corners of his mouth.
"What did we miss?"
asked Galdo.
"Boys," said Chains, "I might have forgotten to tell you something when I introduced you to Jean and showed him around last night. Your old master from Shades Hill warned me that while Jean is mostly soft-spoken, the boy has one hell of a colourful temper."
Shaking his head, Chains stepped over to Locke and helped him stand upright.
"When the world stops spinning," he said, "don't forget that you've got broken glass and radishes to clean up, too."
3. Locke and Jean maintained a healthy distance from one another at the dinner table that night, saying nothing. Carlo and Galdo exchanged exasperated looks approximately several hundred times per minute, but made no attempts at conversation themselves. Preparations for the meal were conducted in near silence, with Chains apparently happy to oblige his sullen crew. Once Locke and Jean had seated themselves at the table, Chains set a carved ivory box down before each of them. The boxes were about a foot long and a foot wide, with hinged covers. Locke immediately recognized them as determiners boxes, delicate Ferrari devices that used clockwork, sliding tiles, and rotating wooden knobs to enable a trained user to rapidly conduct certain mathematical operations. He'd been taught the basics of the device, but it had been months since he'd last used one.
"Locke and Jean," said Father Chains, "if you would be so kind. I have 995 Camorri Solons, and I am taking ship for Tal Verar. I should very much like to have them converted to Solari when I arrive, the Solari currently being worth 4/5 of one Camorri full crown. How many Solari will the changers owe me before their fee is deducted?"
Jean immediately flipped open the lid on his box and set to work, fiddling knobs, flicking tiles, and sliding little wooden rods back and forth. Locke, flustered, followed suit. His own nervous fiddlings with the machine were nowhere near fast enough, for Jean shortly announced,
31 full Solari, with about 9/100 of one left over."
He stuck out the tip of his tongue and calculated for a few more seconds.
4 silver Volani and 2 coppers.
"Marvellous," said Chains. "Jean, you can eat this evening. Locke, I'm afraid you're out of luck. Thank you for trying, nonetheless. You may spend dinner in your quarters, if you wish."
"What?"
Locke felt the blood rushing to his cheeks.
"But that's not how it worked before. You always gave us individual problems, and I haven't used this box for..."
"Would you like another problem, then?"
"Yes."
"Very well. Jean, would you indulge us by doing it as well? Now, a Gereshti galleon sails the Iron Sea, and her captain is quite the penitent fellow. Every hour on the hour he has a sailor throw a loaf of ship's biscuit into the sea as an offering to Iono. Each loaf weighs 14 ounces. The captain is a remarkably neat fellow as well. The captain keeps his biscuit in casks, 1/4 ton apiece. He sails for 1 week even. How many casks does he open? And how much biscuit does the Lord of the Grasping Waters get?"
Again the boys worked their boxes, and again Jean looked up while Locke, little beads of sweat clearly visible on his little forehead, was still working.
"He only opens 1 cask," Jean said, "and he uses 147 pounds of biscuit."
Father Chains clapped softly.
"Very good, Jean. You'll still be eating with us tonight. As for you, Locke, well, I shall call you when the clearing up needs to be done."
"This is ridiculous," Locke huffed. "He works the box better than I do. You set this up for me to lose."
"Ridiculous, is it? You've been putting on airs recently, my dear boy. You've reached that certain age where many boys seem to just sort of fold up their better judgment and set it aside for a few years. Hell, Sabatha's done it too. Part of the reason I sent her off to where she is at the moment. Anyhow, it seems to me that your nose is tilting a little high in the air for someone with a death mark around his throat."
Locke's blush deepened. Jean snuck a furtive glance at him. Carlo and Galdo, who already knew about the shark's tooth, stared fixedly at their empty plates and glasses.
"The world is full of conundrums that will tax your skills. Do you presume that you will always get to choose the ones that best suit your strengths? If I wanted to send a boy to impersonate a money changer's apprentice, who do you think I'd give the job to, if I had to choose between yourself and Jean? It's no choice at all."
"I suppose,"
You suppose too much. You deride your new brother because his figure aspires to the noble girth of my own. Chains rubbed his stomach and grinned mirthlessly. Didn't it ever occur to you that he fits in some places even better than you do because of it? Jean looks like a merchant's son, like a well-fed noble, like a plump little scholar. His appearance could be as much an asset to him as yours is to you.
I guess.
And if you needed any further demonstration that he can do things you cannot, well, why don't I instruct him to wallop the shit out of you one more time?
Locke attempted to spontaneously shrink down inside his tunic and vanish into thin air. Failing, he hung his head.
I'm sorry, said Jean. I hope I didn't hurt you badly.
You don't need to be sorry, Locke mumbled. I suppose I really did deserve it.
The threat of an empty stomach soon rekindles wisdom. Chains smirked. Hardships are arbitrary, Locke. You never know which particular quality in yourself or a fellow is going to get you past them. For example, raise your hands if your surname happens to be Sansa.
Carlo and Galdo did so, a bit hesitantly.
Anyone with the surname Sansa, said Chains, may join our new brother Jean Tannen in dining this evening.
I love being used as an example, said Galdo.
Anyone with the surname Lamora, said Chains, may eat, but first he will serve forth all the courses and attend on Jean Tannen.
So Locke scuttled about, embarrassment and relief mingled on his face. The meal was roasted capons stuffed with garlic and onions, with grapes and figs scalded in a hot wine sauce on the side. Father Chains poured all of his usual prayer toasts, dedicating the last to Jean Tannen, who lost one family but came to another soon enough. At that, Jean's eyes watered, and the boy lost whatever good cheer the food had brought to him. Noticing this, Carlo and Galdo took action to salvage his mood.
"That was really good, what you did with the box," said Carlo. "None of us can work it that fast," said Galdo. "And we're good with sums." "Or at least," said Galdo. "We thought we were, until we met you."
"It was nothing," said Jean. "I can be even faster. I meant to say—"
He looked nervously at Father Chains before continuing.
"I need optics, reading optics, for things up close. I can't see right without them. I could work a box even faster if I had them, but I lost mine. One of the boys in Shades Hill—"
"You shall have new ones," said Chains, "tomorrow or the next day. Don't wear them in public. It might contravene our air of poverty, but you can certainly wear them in here."
"You couldn't even see straight," asked Locke, "when you beat me?" "I could see a little bit," said Jean. "It's all sort of blurry. That's why I was leaning back so far."
"A mathematical terror," mused Father Chains, "and a capable little brawler. What an interesting combination the benefactor has given the gentleman bastards in young Master Tannen. And he is a gentleman bastard, isn't he, Locke?"
"Yes," said Locke. "I suppose he is."
4. The next night was clear and dry. All the moons were up, shining like sovereigns in the blackness with the stars for their court. Jean Tannen sat beneath one parapet wall on the temple roof, a book held out before him at arm's length. 2 oil lamps in glass boxes sat beside him, outlining him in warm yellow light.
"I don't mean to bother you,"
said Locke, and Jean looked up, startled.
"Gods, you're quiet."
"Not all the time." Locke stepped to within a few feet of the larger boy.
"I can be very loud when I'm being stupid. Can I sit?"
Jean nodded, and Locke plopped down beside him.
He folded his legs and wrapped his arm around his knees.
"I am sorry," said Locke. "I guess I really can be a shit sometimes." "I'm sorry, too. I didn't mean... when I hit you, it just... I'm not myself when I'm angry." "You did right. I didn't know about your mother and your father. I'm sorry. I shouldn't have presumed. I've had a long time to get used to it, you know."
The two boys said nothing for a few moments after that. Jean closed his book and stared up at the sky.
"You know, I might not even be one after all," Locke said. "A real orphan, I mean."
"How so?"
"Well, my mother's dead. I saw that. I know that. But my father, he went away when I was very little. I don't remember him. Never knew him."
"I'm sorry," said Jean.
"We're both sorry a lot, aren't we? I think he might have been a sailor or something. Maybe a mercenary, you know? Mother never wanted to talk about him. I don't know. I could be wrong."
"My father was a good man," said Jean. "He was... they both had a shop in North Corner. They shipped leathers and silks and some gems. All over the Iron Sea, some trips inland. I helped them. Not shipping, of course, but record-keeping, counting. And I took care of the cats. We had 9. Mama used to say... she used to say that I was her only child who didn't go about on all fours."
He sniffled a bit and wiped his eyes.
"I seem to have used up all my tears," he said. "I don't know what to feel about all this any more. My parents taught me to be honest, that the laws and the gods abhor thieving. But now I find out thieving has its very own god, and I can either starve on the street or be comfortable here."
"It's not so bad," said Locke. "I've never done anything else, as long as I can remember. Thieving is an honest trade, when you look at it like we do. We can work really hard at it sometimes."
Locke reached inside his tunic and brought out a soft cloth bag.
"Here,"
he said, handing it over to Jean.
What's this?" "You said you needed optics."
Locke smiled.
"There's a lens grinder over in the Videnza who's older than the gods. He doesn't watch his shop window like he ought to. I lifted some pairs for you."
Jean shook the bag open and found himself looking down at 3 pairs of optics. There were 2 circular sets of lenses in gilt wire frames and a square set with silver rims.
"I... thank you, Locke."
He held each pair up to his eyes and squinted through them in turn, frowning slightly.
"I don't quite know. I'm not ungrateful, not at all, but none of these will work."
He pointed at his eyes and smiled sheepishly.
"Lenses need to be made for the wearer's problem. There's some for people who can't see long ways, and I think that's what these pairs are for. But I'm what they call close blind, not far blind."
"Oh, damn." Locke scratched the back of his neck and smiled sheepishly.
"I don't wear them. I didn't know. I really am an idiot."
"Not at all. I can keep the rims and do something with them, maybe. Rims break. I can just set proper lenses in them. There'll be spares. Thank you again."
The boys sat in silence for a short while after that, but this time it was a companionable silence. Jean leaned back against the wall and closed his eyes. Locke stared up at the moons, straining to see the little blue and green specks Chains had once told him were the forests of the gods. Eventually, Jean cleared his throat.
"So you're really good at stealing things?"
"I have to be good at something. It's not fighting, and it's not mathematics, I guess."
Father Chains told me about this thing you can do if you pray to the benefactor. He called it a death offering. Do you know about that?"
"Oh," said Locke, "I know all about it. Truth of all 13 gods, cross my heart and pray to die."
"I'd like to do that, for my mother and my father, but I've never stolen anything. Can you maybe help me?"
"Teach you how to steal, so you can do a proper offering?"
"Yes."
Jean sighed.
I guess if this is where the gods have put me, I should bend to local custom. Can you teach me how to use a numbers box so I look less like a half-wit next time?
I think so, said Jean.
Then it's settled. Locke jumped back up to his feet and spread his hands wide. Tomorrow, Carlo and Galdo can plant their arses on the temple steps. You and I will go out and plunder.
That sounds dangerous, said Jean.
For anyone else, maybe. For gentlemen bastards, well, it's just what we do.
We?
We.
Chapter 6. Limitations. 1. The red hands led Locke up the long gangway to the floating grave just as the scarlet sun broke above the dark buildings of the Ashfall district. The whole wooden waste turned to blood in that light, and when Locke blinked to clear the brightness from his eyes, even the darkness flashed with red. Locke struggled to keep his head clear. The combination of nervous excitement and fatigue always made him feel as though he was sliding along an inch or two above the ground, his feet not quite reaching all the way down. There were sentries on the quay, sentries at the doors, sentries in the foyer, more than there had been before. They were all grim-faced and silent as the red hands led Locke deeper into the Kappa's floating fortress. The inner clockwork doors weren't locked. Kappa Barsavi stood in the middle of his great audience chamber, facing away from Locke, his head bowed and his hands behind his back. Curtains had been drawn away from the high glass windows on the eastern side of the galleon's hull. Red fingers of light fell on Barsavi, his sons, a large wooden cask, and a long object that lay covered on a portable wooden bier.
"Father," said Andres, "it's La Mora."
Kappa Barsavi grunted and turned. He stared at Locke for a few seconds, his eyes glassy and dead. He waved his left hand.
"Leave us," he said. "Leave us now."
Heads down, Andres and Pachero hurried out of the room, dragging the red hands with them. A moment later, the hall echoed with the sound of the doors slamming shut and the clockwork locks tumbling into position.
"Your Honor," said Locke, "what's going on?"
The bastard killed her, Locke. He killed Nazca last night, left us the body just a few hours ago.
Locke stared at Barsavi, dumbfounded, aware that his mouth was hanging open.
But she was here, wasn't she?
She left. Barsavi was clenching and unclenching his fists. She snuck off, near as we can tell, or she was taken. Second or third hour of the morning. She was returned at 4:30 the fourth hour of the morning.
Returned? By whom?
Come, see.
Vencarlo Barsavi drew back the cloth that covered the bier, and there lay Nazca, her skin waxy, her eyes closed, her hair damp. Two livid purple bruises marred the otherwise smooth skin on the left side of her neck. Locke felt his eyes stinging, and he found himself biting down hard on the first knuckle of his right index finger.
"See what the bastard has done," Barsavi said softly. "She was the living memory of her mother, my only daughter. I would rather be dead than see this."
Tears began sliding down the old man's cheeks.
"She has been washed."
"Washed? What do you mean?"
"She was returned," said the Kappa. "In that."
He gestured to the cask, which stood upright a few feet to the side of the bier.
"In a barrel?"
"Look inside."
Locke slid the barrel's cover back and recoiled as the full stench of the barrel's contents wafted out at him. It was full of urine, horse urine, dark and cloudy. Locke whirled away from the cask and clapped both hands over his mouth, his stomach spasming.
"Not just killed," said Barsavi, "but drowned. Drowned in horse piss."
Locke growled, fighting tears.
I can't believe this. I just can't believe it. This doesn't make any fucking sense.
He moved back beside the bier and took another look at Nazca's neck. The purple bruises were actually raised bumps. Straight red scratches were visible just in front of them. Locke stared at them, thinking back to the feel of talons in his own skin. The injury on his forearm still burned. "Your Honor," he said slowly, "maybe she was returned in that thing, but I'm pretty sure she didn't drown in it."
"What can you possibly mean?"
"The marks on her neck, the little scratches beside them?" Locke extemporized, keeping his voice level and his face neutral. "What would sound plausible?"
"I've, seen them before. Several years ago in Talisham. I saw a man murdered by a scorpion hawk. Have you ever heard of such a thing?"
"Yes," said the Kappa. "An unnatural hybrid, some sort of creature dreamed up by the sorcerers of Carthain. Is that the marks on her neck? Can you be sure?"
"She was stung by a scorpion hawk," Locke said. "The talon marks beside the wounds are clear. She would have been dead almost instantly."
"So he merely pickled her afterward," Barsavi whispered. "To increase the insult, to cut me more cruelly."
"I'm sorry," said Locke. "I know it. It can't be much comfort."
"If you're right, it was a much quicker death."
Barsavi pulled the cloth back up over her head, running his fingers through her hair one last time before he covered her completely.
"If that is the only comfort I can pray that my little girl received, I will pray for it. That grey bastard will receive no such comfort when his time comes. I swear it."
"Why would he do this?"
Locke ran both of his hands through his hair, wide-eyed with agitation.
"It doesn't make any sense. Why her? Why now?"
"He can tell you himself," said Barsavi.
"What? I don't understand."
Kappa Barsavi reached into his vest and drew out a folded piece of parchment. He passed it over to Locke, who opened the fold and saw that a note was scribed there in a clean, even hand. "Barsavi, for the necessity of what was done, we apologize, though it was done to facilitate your understanding of our power, and therefore your cooperation. We earnestly desire a meeting with yourself, man to man, in all courtesy, to settle once and for all between us this matter of Camor. We shall be in attendance at the Echo Hole, at the 11th hour of the evening, on the Duke's Day 3 nights hence. We shall be alone and unarmed, though you, for your part, may bring as many counsellors as you wish, and you may arm them as you wish. Man to man, we may discuss our situation, and with the kind favour of the gods, perhaps abjure the need for you to lose any more of your loyal subjects, or any more of your own flesh and blood."
"I don't believe it," said Locke. "Meet in good faith after this?"
"He cannot be Camori," said Barsavi. "I have become Camori in my years here. I am more of this place than many who were born here, but this man..."
Barsavi shook his head vigorously.
"He cannot understand what an infamy he has done to get my attention. What an insult my sons and I must bear if I negotiate with him. He wastes his time with this letter, and look, the royal we. What an affectation!"
"Your Honor, what if he does understand what he's done?"
"The possibility is very remote, Locke."
The Kappa chuckled sadly.
"Or else he would not have done it."
"Not if you presume that the meeting at the Echo Hole is an ambush, that he wants to get you off the floating grave and into a place where he has prepared some real harm for you."
"Your prudence again." Barsavi smiled without humour. "The thought has occurred to me, Locke. But if he wanted me dead, why not strike from surprise months ago, before he started killing my garistas? No, I believe he genuinely thinks that if he frightens me enough, I will negotiate in good faith. I'm indeed going to the Echo Hall. We shall have our meeting. And for my counselors, I will bring my sons, my Berangius sisters, and 100 of my best and my cruelest, and I will bring you and your friend Jean.
Locke's heart beat against the inside of his chest like a trapped bird. He wanted to scream.
Of course, he said. Of course. Jean and I will do anything you ask. I'm grateful for the opportunity.
Good. Because the only negotiation we'll be doing is with bolt, blade, and fist. I've got a surprise for that gray piece of shit, if he thinks to dictate terms to me over the body of my only daughter.
Locke ground his teeth together. I know what can bring him out from that soggy fortress of his, the Grey King had said.
Kappa Barsavi, said Locke, have you considered, well, the things they say about the Grey King? He can kill men with a touch. He can walk through walls. He can't be harmed by blades or by arrows.
Stories told in wine. He does as I did when I first took this city. He hides himself well, and he chooses his targets wisely.
The Kappa sighed.
I admit that he is good at it, perhaps as good as I was. But he's not a ghost.
There is another possibility, said Locke, licking his lips. How much of what was said here might reach the Grey King's ears? He'd unraveled the secrets of the gentleman bastards thoroughly enough. To hell with him.
The possibility of a bondsmage. Aiding the Grey King?
Yes.
He's been vexing my city for months, Locke. It might explain some things, yes, but the price. Even I could not pay a bondsmage for that length of time.
Scorpion hawks, said Locke, aren't just created by the bondsmagi. As far as I know, only bondsmagi themselves keep them. Could an ordinary falconer train a bird that could kill him with one accidental sting? Bullshit well, he thought. Bullshit very well. The Grey King wouldn't need to have kept one this whole time. What if the bondsmage is newly arrived? What if the bondsmage has only been hired for the next few days, the critical point of whatever the Grey King's scheme is? The rumours about the Grey King's powers could have been spread to prepare for all of this.
Fantastical, said Barsavi, and yet it would explain much.
It would explain why the Grey King is willing to meet you alone and unarmed. With a bondsmage to shield him, he could appear both, yet be neither.
Then my response is unchanged.
Barsavi squeezed one fist inside the other.
If one bondsmage can best 100 knives, including you and I, my sons, my Berangius sisters, your friend Jean and his hatchets, then the Grey King has chosen his weapons better than I. But for my part, I do not imagine that he has.
You will keep the possibility in mind? Locke persisted.
Yes, I shall.
Barsavi placed a hand on Locke's shoulder.
You must forgive me, my boy, for what has happened.
There's nothing to forgive, Your Honor. When the Kappa changes the subject, thought Locke, the subject is finished. It wasn't your fault.
It is my war. It's me the Grey King truly wishes to cut.
You offered me a great deal, sir. Locke licked his lips, which had suddenly gone dry. I'd very much like to help you kill the bastard.
So we shall. At the ninth hour of the evening, on Duke's Day, we begin to gather. Andres will come to fetch you and Tannen at the last mistake.
What of the Sansas? They're good with knives.
And with cards, or so I hear. I like them well enough, Locke, but they're fiddlers, amusers. I'm taking serious folk for serious business.
As you say.
Now.
Barsavi took a silk handkerchief from his vest pocket and slowly mopped his brow and cheeks with it.
Leave me, please. Come back tomorrow night as a priest.
I'll have all my other priests of the benefactor. We'll give her a proper ritual.
Despite himself, Locke was flattered. The Kappa had known that all of Father Chain's boys were initiates of the benefactor, and Locke a full priest, but he'd never before asked for Locke's blessing in any official sense.
Of course, he said quietly.
He withdrew then, leaving the Kappa standing in the bloody morning light, leaving him all alone at the heart of his fortress, for the second time, with nothing but a corpse for company.
2.
Gentlemen,
said Locke, huffing and puffing as he closed the door to the seventh floor rooms behind him.
We have done our bit for appearances this week. Let's all work out of the temple until further notice.
Jean was sitting in a chair facing the door, hatchets resting on his thigh, with his battered old volume of the Corish romances in his hands. Bug was snoring on a sleeping pallet, sprawled in one of those utterly careless positions that give instant arthritis to all save the very young and foolish. The Sansas were sitting against the far wall, playing a desultory hand of cards. They looked up as Locke entered.
"We are released from one complication," said Locke, "and flung headlong into another. And this bitch has teeth."
"What news?" said Jean. "The worst sort." Locke dropped into a chair, threw back his head and closed his eyes.
Nazca's dead.
What?
Carlo leapt to his feet. Galdo wasn't far behind.
How did that happen?
The Grey King happened.
It must have been the other business he referred to when I was his guest. He sent the body back to her father in a vat of horse piss.
Gods, said Jean. I'm so sorry, Locke.
And now, continued Locke, you and I are expected to accompany the Kappa when he avenges her at the clandestine meeting 3 nights hence, which will be at the Echo Hole, by the way, and the Kappa's idea of clandestine is 100 knives charging in to cut the Grey King to bloody pieces.
Cut you to bloody pieces, you mean? Said Galdo.
I'm well aware of who's supposed to be strutting around wearing the Grey King's clothes, thanks very much. I'm just debating whether or not I should hang an archery butt around my neck. Oh, and wondering if I can learn to split myself in two before Duke's Day.
This entire situation is insane.
Jean slammed his book shut in disgust.
It was insane before. Now it's become malicious.
Why would the Grey King kill Nazca?
To get the Kappa's attention.
Locke sighed. Either to frighten him, which it certainly hasn't accomplished, or to piss him off beyond all mortal measure, which it has.
There will never be peace now. The Kappa will kill the Grey King or get himself killed trying.
Carlo paced furiously.
Surely the Grey King must realize this. He hasn't facilitated negotiations. He's made them impossible. Forever.
The thought had crossed my mind, said Locke, that the Grey King may not be telling us everything concerning this scheme of his.
Out the Viscount's gate, then, said Galdo. We can spend the afternoon securing transportation and goods. We can pack up our fortune, vanish onto the road. Fuck, if we can't find somewhere to build another life with 40-odd thousand crowns at our fingertips, we don't deserve to live. We could buy titles in Lashane, make Bug a count and set ourselves up as his household. Or make ourselves counts, said Carlo, and set Bug up as our household. Run him back and forth. It'd be good for his moral education.
We can't, said Locke. We have to presume the Grey King can follow us wherever we go, or perhaps more accurately, that his bondsmage can. So long as the Falconer serves him, we can't run, at least not as a first option.
What about as a second? Asked Jean.
If it comes to that, we might as well try. We can get things ready, and if we absolutely must run for the road, well, we'll put ourselves in harness and pull with the horses if we have to.
Which leaves only the conundrum, said Jean, of which commitment to slip you out of the night of this meeting at the Echo Hole.
No conundrum, said Locke. The Grey King has it over us.
Barsavi, we know we can fool. So I'll play the Grey King and figure out some way to ease us out of our commitment to the Kappa without getting executed for it.
That would be a good trick, said Jean.
But what if it's not necessary? Carlo pointed at his brother. One of us can play the Grey King, and you and Jean can stand beside Barsavi as required.
Yes, said Galdo. An excellent idea.
No, said Locke. For one thing, I'm a better false facer than either of you, and you know it. You two are just slightly too conspicuous. It can't be risked. For another, while I'm playing the Grey King, you two will be forgotten by everyone. You'll be free to move around as you like. I'd rather have you waiting with transportation at one of our meeting spots in case things go sour and we do need to flee.
And what about Bug?
Bug, said Bug, has been faking snoring for the past few minutes, and I know the Echo Hole. I used to hide there sometimes when I was with the Shades Hill gang. I'll be down there under the floor beside the waterfall, watching for trouble.
Bug, said Locke,
If you don't like it, you'll have to lock me in a box to stop me. You need a spotter, and the Grey King didn't say you couldn't have friends lurking. That's what I do. I lurk. None of you can do it like I can, because you're all bigger and slower and creakier and...
Gods, said Locke. My days as a Garista are numbered. Duke Bug is dictating the terms of his service. Very well, Your Grace. I'll give you a role that will keep you close at hand, but you lurk where I tell you to lurk, right?
Bloody right!
Then it's settled, said Locke. And if no one else has a pressing need for me to imitate the great and powerful, or a friend of mine they'd like to murder, I could use some sleep.
It's too goddamned bad about Nazca, said Galdo. The son of a bitch.
Yes, said Locke. In fact, I'm going to speak to him about it this very evening. Him or his pet sorcerer, whichever thinks to come.
The candle, said Jean.
Yeah. After you and I finish our business, and after false light, you can wait down in the last mistake. I'll sit up here, light it, and wait for them to show.
Locke grinned. Let those fuckers enjoy the walk up our stairs.
3. The day turned out clear and pleasant, the evening as fresh as they ever came in Camor. Locke sat in the 7th-floor rooms with the windows open and the mesh screens down as the purple sky lit up with rising streamers of ghostly light. The falconer's candle smouldered on the table beside the remains of Locke's small dinner and a half-empty bottle of wine. The other half of that bottle was warming Locke's stomach as he sat, facing the door, massaging the fresh dressing Jean had insisted on wrapping his arm with before taking up his post in the last mistake.
"Crooked Warden," said Locke to thin air, "if I'm pissing you off for some reason, you don't need to go to such elaborate lengths to chastise me. And if I'm not pissing you off, well, I pray that you still find me amusing."
He flexed the fingers of his injured arm, wincing, then took up his wine glass and the bottle one more time.
"A glass poured to air for an absent friend," he said as he filled it with dark red wine, a Nakotsa Retsina that had actually come from Don Salvara's upriver vineyards, a gift to Lucas Fairwhite as he stepped off the Don's pleasure barge so many days earlier, or not so many days earlier. It felt like a lifetime.
"We miss Nazca Barsavi already, and we wish her well. She was a fair Garista, and she tried to help her Pezon out of an untenable situation for them both. She deserved better. Piss on me all you like, but do what you can for her. I beg this as your servant."
"If you wish to measure a man's true penitence," said the falconer, "observe him when he believes himself to be dining alone."
The front door was just closing behind the bondsmage. Locke had not seen or heard it open. For that matter, it had been bolted. The falconer was without his bird, and dressed in the same wide-skirted grey coat with silver-buttoned scarlet cuffs Locke had seen the night before.
A grey velvet cap was tilted back atop his head, adorned with a single feather under a silver pin, easily identified as having come from Vestris.
"I, for one, have never been a very penitent man," he continued, "nor have I ever been overly fond of stairs."
"My heart is overcome with sorrow for your hardship," said Locke. "Where's your hawk?"
"Circling."
Locke was suddenly acutely aware of the open windows, such a comfort just a moment earlier. The mesh wouldn't keep Vestris out if the hawk decided to be unruly.
"I'd hoped that your master might come along with you."
"My client," said the bondsmage, "is otherwise occupied. I speak for him, and I will bear your words to him, assuming you have any worth hearing."
"I always have words," said Locke, "words like complete lunatic and fucking idiot. Did it ever occur to you or your client that the one certain way to ensure that a Komori would never negotiate with you with any good faith would be to kill someone of his blood?"
"Heavens," said the falconer, "this is ill news indeed. And here the Grey King was so certain Barsavi would interpret his daughter's murder as a friendly gesture."
The sorcerer's eyebrows rose.
"I say, did you want to tell him yourself, or shall I rush off right now with your revelation?"
"Very funny, you half-copper cocksucker. While I agreed under duress to prance around dressed as your master, you must admit that sending the copper's only daughter back to him in a vat of piss does complicate my fucking job."
"A pity," said the bondsmage. "But the task remains, as does the duress."
"Barsavi wants me by his side at this meeting, Falconer. He made the request this morning. Maybe I might have slipped out of it before, but now? Nazca's murder has put me in a hell of a squeeze."
"You're the Thorn of Camor. I would be personally very disappointed if you couldn't find a way past this difficulty. Barsavi's summons is a request. My client's is a requirement."
"Your client isn't telling me everything he should."
"You may safely presume that he knows his own business better than you do."
The falconer began to idly wind a slender thread back and forth between the fingers of his right hand. It had an odd silver sheen. "Gods damn it," Locke hissed. "Maybe I don't care what happens to the copper, but Nazca was my friend. Duress I can accept. Gleeful malice I cannot. You fuckers didn't need to do what you did to her." The falconer splayed his fingers and the thread gleamed, woven into a sort of cat's cradle. He began to move his fingers slowly, tightening some threads and loosening others, as deftly as the Sansas moved coins across the backs of their hands.
"I cannot tell you," said the sorcerer, "what a weight it is upon my conscience to learn that we might lose your gracious acceptance."
Then the falconer hissed a word, a single syllable in a language Locke didn't understand. The very sound was harsh and unnerving. It echoed in the room as though heard from a distance. The wood shutters behind Locke slammed closed, and he jumped out of his chair. One by one, the other windows banged shut, and their little clasps clicked, moved by an unseen hand. The falconer shifted his fingers yet again. Light gleamed on the web within his hands, and Locke gasped. His knees suddenly ached as though they'd been kicked from the sides, sharply.
"This is the second time," said the bondsmage, "that you have been flippant with me. I fail to find it amusing. So I will reinforce my client's instructions, and I shall take my time doing so."
Locke gritted his teeth. Tears sprang unbidden to his eyes as the pain in his legs intensified, throbbed, spread. It now felt as though a cold flame were playing against his knee sockets from the inside. Unable to support his own weight, he tottered forward. One hand clutched helplessly at his legs, while the other tried to hold him up against the table. He glared at the bondsmage and tried to speak, but found that the muscles of his neck began spasming as he did.
You are property, Lamora. You belong to the Grey King. He cares not that Nazca Barsavi was your friend. It was her ill fortune to be born to the father the gods gave her.
The spasming spread down Locke's spine, across his arms and down his legs, where it met the freezing, gnawing pain already at work there in a hideous fusion. He fell onto his back, gasping, his face a rictus mask, his hands curved in the air above his head like claws.
You look like an insect thrown into a fire, and this is the merest exercise of my art. The things I could do to you if I were to stitch your true name into cloth or scribe it on parchment. Lamora is obviously not your given name. It's Thrown Therin for shadow. But your first name, now that would be just enough to master you if I wished to make use of it.
The falconer's fingers flew back and forth, blurring in Locke's vision, shifting and stretching those silver threads, and the tempo of Locke's torment rose in direct proportion to the motion of that gleaming design. His heels were slapping against the floor, his teeth were rattling in his jaw. It seemed to him that someone was trying to cut the bones out of his thighs with icicles. Again and again he tried to suck in enough air to scream, but his lungs would not move. His throat was packed with thorns, and the world was growing black and red at the edges. Release itself was a shock. He lay on the ground, bonelessly, still feeling the ghosts of pain throbbing across his body. Warm tears slid down his cheeks.
"You're not a particularly intelligent man, Lamora. An intelligent man would never deliberately waste my time. An intelligent man would grasp the nuances of the situation without the need for repetition."
Another motion of blurred silver in the corner of Locke's vision, and new pain erupted in his chest, like a blossom of fire surrounding his heart. He could feel it there, burning the very core of his being. It seemed to him that he could actually smell the crisping flesh within his lungs, and feel the air in his throat warming until it was as hot as that of a bread oven. Locke groaned, writhed, threw his head back, and finally screamed.
"I need you," said the falconer, "but I will have you meek and grateful for my forbearance. Your friends are another matter. Shall I do this to Bug while you watch? Shall I do it to the Sansas?"
"No! Please, no!"
Locke cried out, curled in agony, his hands clutching at his left breast. He found himself tearing at his tunic like an animal mad with pain.
"Not them!"
"Why not? They are immaterial to my client. They are expendable."
The burning pain abated, once again shocking Locke with its absence. He huddled on his side, breathing raggedly, unable to believe that heat so fierce could vanish so swiftly.
"Yes. Yes," said Locke. "Perfectly. Yes. Please don't harm them. I'll do whatever I must."
"Of course you will. Now, I've brought the components of the costume you'll be wearing at the Echo Hole. You'll find them just outside your door. They're appropriately theatrical. I won't presume to tell you how to make ready with your mummery. Be in position across from the Echo Hole at 10:30 on the night of the meeting. I shall guide you from there and direct you in what to say."
"Barsavi," Locke coughed out. "Barsavi will mean to kill me."
"Do you doubt that I could continue punishing you here at my leisure until you were mad with pain?"
"No, no."
"Then do not doubt that I can protect you from whatever nonsense the Kappa might wish to employ."
How do you mean to direct me?"
"I do not need the air,"
came the voice of the bondsmage, echoing in Locke's head with shocking force,
"to carry forth my instructions. When you require prompting in your meeting with Barsavi, I shall supply it,
When you must make a demand or accept a demand, I shall let you know how to proceed. Is this clear?
Yes, perfectly clear. Thank you.
You should be grateful for what my client and I have done on your behalf. Many men wait years for a chance to ingratiate themselves with Kappa Barsavi. Your chance has been served forth to you like a fine meal. Are we not generous?
Yes, certainly.
Just so. I suggest you now find some means to extricate yourself from the duty he asks of you. This will leave you free to concentrate on the duty we require. We wouldn't want your attention divided at a critical moment.
4. The last mistake was half empty, a phenomenon Locke had never before witnessed. Conversation was muted, eyes were cold and hard. Entire gangs were conspicuous by their absence. Men and women alike wore heavier clothing than the season required, more half-cloaks and coats and layered vests. It was easier to conceal weapons that way.
So what the hell happened to you?
Jean helped Locke sit down. He'd gotten them a small table in a side cranny of the tavern, with a clear view of the doors. Locke settled into his chair, a slight echo of the falconer's phantom pain still haunting his joints and his neck muscles.
The falconer, Locke said in a low voice, had several opinions he wished to express, and apparently I'm not as charming as I think I am.
He idly fingered his torn tunic and sighed.
Beer now, bitch later.
Jean slid over a clay mug of warm Komori ale, and Locke drank half of it down in two gulps.
Well, he said after wiping his mouth, I suppose it was worth it just to say what I said to him. I don't believe Bonds Magi are used to being insulted.
Did you accomplish anything?
No.
Locke drank the remaining half of his ale and turned the mug upside down before setting it on the tabletop.
Not a god's damned thing. I did get the shit tortured out of myself, though, which was informational from a certain point of view.
That fucker. Jean's hands balled into fists. I could do so much to him without killing him. I very much hope I get to try.
Save it for the Grey King, muttered Locke. My thoughts are that if we survive what's coming on Duke's Day night, he won't be able to keep the falconer on retainer forever. When the bondsmage leaves, we talk to the Grey King again. With knives.
Too right. We follow him if we have to. We've been needing something to do with all of our money. Here's something. Whenever that bastard can't pay his mage any more, we'll show him just how much we like being knocked around like handballs. Even if we have to follow him down the Iron Sea and around the Cape of Nessek and all the way to Balinel on the Sea of Brass.
Now there's a plan. And what are you going to do tonight?
Tonight? Locke grunted. I'm going to take Carlo's advice. I'm going to stroll over to the Gilded Lilies and get my brains wrenched out. They can put them back in the morning when they're through with me. I understand there's an extra fee involved, but I'll pay it.
I must be going mad, said Jean. It's been 4 years, and all this time you've been...
I'm frustrated and I need a break. And she's 1,000 miles away, and I guess I'm human after all, gods damn it. Don't wait up.
I'll walk with you, said Jean. It's not wise to be out alone on a night like this. The city's in a mood, now that word of Nazca's got around.
Not wise? Locke laughed. I'm the safest man in Camor, Jean. I know for a fact I'm the only one that absolutely nobody out there wants to kill yet. Not until they've finished pulling my strings.
5. This isn't working, he said, less than 2 hours later. I'm sorry, it's not your fault.
The room was warm and dark and exceedingly pleasant, ventilated by the soft swish of a wooden fan flapping back and forth in a concealed shaft. Water wheels churned outside the ornate house of the Gilded Lilies at the northern tip of the snare,
driving belts and chains to operate many mechanisms of comfort. Locke lay on a wide bed with soft feather mattresses covered in silk sheets and overhung with a silk canopy. He sprawled naked in the soft red light of a misted alchemical globe, little stronger than scarlet moonlight, and admired the soft curves of the woman who was running her hands along the insides of his thighs. She smelled like mulled apple wine and cinnamon musk, and her curves were indeed admirable, yet he was nothing resembling aroused.
"Felice, please," he said. "This was a bad idea."
"You're tense," whispered Felice. "You've obviously got something on your mind, and that cut on your arm, it can't be helping at all. Let me try a few things more. I'm always up for a professional challenge."
"I can't imagine anything would help." Locke could hear the pout in her voice, though her face was little more than soft slashes of shadow in the red half-light.
"There's wines, you know. Alchemical ones from Talvarar. Aphrodisiacs. Not cheap, but they do work."
She rubbed his stomach, toying with the slender line of hair that ran down its center.
"They can work miracles."
"I don't need wine," he said distantly, grabbing her hand and moving it away from his chin. "Gods, I don't know what I need."
"Allow me to make a suggestion, then."
She moved herself up on the bed until she was crouched beside his chest, on her knees. With one confident motion, for there was real muscle under those curves, she flipped him over onto his stomach and began kneading the muscles of his neck and back, alternating gentle caresses and firm pressure.
"Suggestion, ow, accepted."
"Locke,"
Felice said, losing the breathy, anything-to-please-you bedroom voice that was one of the cherished illusions of her trade.
"You do know that the attendants in the waiting chambers tell us exactly what each client requests when they give us assignments."
"So I've heard."
"Well, I know you specifically asked for a redhead."
"Which..." "Ow! Lower, please."
"Which means?" "There's only two of us in the Lilies," she said, "and we get that request every now and again. But the thing is, some men want any redhead in general, and some men want one redhead in particular."
"Oh."
"Those that want a redhead in general have their fun and go their way, but you want one redhead in particular, and I'm not her."
"I'm sorry, I said it's not your fault."
"I know, that's ever so gracious of you."
"And I'm happy paying anyways."
"And that's also sweet," she chuckled. "But you'd be taking it up with the room full of armed men if you didn't, not just worrying about hurting my poor feelings."
"You know," Locke said, "I think I prefer you like this to all that 'how may I please you, master' bullshit earlier."
"Well, some men like a straightforward whore. Some don't want to hear anything but how wonderful they are."
She worked at his neck muscles with the bases of her palms.
"It's all business. But like I said, you seem to be pining for someone. And now that you've remembered yourself, I won't do."
"Sorry."
"No need to keep apologizing to me. You're the one whose lady love ran halfway across the continent."
"Gods," Locke groaned. "Find me a single person in Camor who doesn't know, and I'll give you 100 crowns, I swear."
"It's just something I heard from one of the Sansas."
"One of the Sansas? Which one?"
"Couldn't say. They're so hard to tell apart in the dark."
"I'm going to cut their god's damned tongues out."
"Oh, tss." She ruffled his hair. "Please don't. Us girls have a use for those, at least." "You poor sweet idiot. You do have it bad for her. Well, what can I say, Locke? You're fucked."
Felice laughed softly.
"Just not by me."
This is the end of the CD. The audiobook continues on the next CD.
Interlude. Brat Masterpieces. 1.
The summer after Jean came to the Gentleman Bastards, Father Chains took him and Locke up to the temple roof one night after dinner. Chains smoked a paper-wrapped sheaf of Jeremite tobacco, while the sunlight sank beneath the horizon and the court fire of the city's elderglass rose glimmering in its place. That night he wanted to talk about the eventual necessity of cutting throats.
"I had this talk with Carlo and Galdo and Sabatha last year," he began. "You boys are investments in time and treasure both."
He exhaled ragged crescents of pale smoke, failing as usual to conjure full rings.
"Big investments, my life's work, maybe. A pair of brat masterpieces. So I want you to remember that you can't always smile your way around a fight. If someone pulls steel on you, I expect you to survive. Sometimes that means giving back in kind. Sometimes it means running like your ass is on fire. Always it means knowing which is the right choice, and that's why we've got to talk about your inclinations."
Chains fixed Locke with a stare while he took a long, deliberate drag on his sheaf, the final breath of a man treading in unpleasant water, preparing to go under the surface.
"You and I both know that you have multiple talents, Locke, genuine gifts for a great many things. So I have to give this to you straight. If it comes down to hard talk with a real foe, you're nothing but a pair of pissed breeches and a bloodstain. You can kill, all right, that's the God's own truth, but you're just not made for stand-up, face-to-face bruising, and you know it, right?"
Locke's red-cheeked silence was an answer in itself. Suddenly unable to look Father Chains in the eyes, he tried to pretend that his feet were fascinating objects that he'd never seen before.
"Locke, Locke, we can't all be mad dogs with a blade in our hands, and it's nothing to sob about, so let's not see that lip of yours quivering like an old whore's tits, right? You will learn steel, and you'll learn rope, and you'll learn the alley piece, but you'll learn them sneak style. In the back, from the side, from above, in the dark."
Chains grabbed an imaginary opponent from behind, left hand round the throat, right hand thrusting at kidney level with his half-smoked sheaf for a dagger.
"All the twists, because fighting wisely will keep you from getting cut to mince."
Chains pretended to wipe the blood from his ember-tipped blade, then took another drag.
"That's that. Put it in your hat and wear it to town, Locke. We need to face our shortcomings head on. The old saying for a gang is, lies go out, but the truth stays home."
He forced twin streams of smoke from his nostrils and cheered up visibly as the tails of grey vapour swirled around his head.
"Now quit acting like there's a fucking naked woman on your shoes, will you?"
Locke did grin at that. Weakly, but he also looked up and nodded.
"Now you,"
Chains said, turning to regard Jean.
"We all know you've got the sort of temper that cracks skulls when it's off the leash. We've got a properly evil brain in Locke here, a fantastic liar. Carlo and Galdo are silver at all trades and gold at none. Sabatha's the born queen of all the charmers that ever lived. But what we don't have yet is a plain old bruiser. I think it could be you, a stand-up brawler to keep your friends out of trouble, a real rabid dog bastard with steel in your hand. Care to give it a go?"
Jean's eyes were immediately drawn down to the fascinating spectacle of his own feet.
Well, if you think that would be good, I can try."
"Jean, I've seen you angry."
"I felt you angry," said Locke, grinning.
"And give me some credit for being five times your fucking age, Jean. You don't smoulder and you don't make threats, you just go cold, and then you make things happen. Some folks are made for hard situations."
He drew smoke from his sheaf once again, and flicked white ashes to the stones beneath his feet.
I think you have the knack for smacking brains out of heads. That's neither good nor bad in itself, but it's something we can use.
Jean seemed to think this over for a few moments, but Locke and Chains could both see the decision already made in his eyes. They had gone hard and hungry under his black tangle of hair, and his nod was just a formality.
Good, good. Thought you'd like the idea, so I took the liberty of making arrangements.
He produced a black leather wallet from one of the pockets of his coat and handed it over to Jean.
12:30 tomorrow. You're expected at the House of Glass Roses.
Locke and Jean both widened their eyes at the mention of Camors' best-known and most exclusive school of arms. Jean flipped the sigil wallet open. Inside was a flat token, a stylized rose in frosted glass fused directly onto the inner surface of the leather. With this, Jean could pass north over the Angevine and past the guard posts to the Alchigrante Islands. It placed him under the direct protection of Don Tomsa Maranzala, master of the House of Glass Roses.
That rose will get you over the river and up among the swells, but don't fuck around once you're up there. Do what you're told. Go straight there and come straight back. You go 4 times a week from now on. And for all our sakes, tame that mess on top of your head. Use fire and a poleaxe if you have to.
Chains took a final drag of evergreen-scented smoke from his rapidly disappearing sheaf, then flicked the butt up and over the roof wall. His last exhalation of the night sailed over the heads of the two boys, a wobbly but otherwise fully formed ring.
Fuck me, an omen.
Chains reached after the drifting ring as though he could pluck it back for examination.
Either this scheme is fated to work out, or the gods are pleased with me for engineering your demise, Jean Tannen. I love a win-win proposition. Now don't you two have work to do?
2. In the House of Glass Roses there was a hungry garden. The place was Camor in microcosm, a thing of the Eldrin left behind for men to puzzle over, a dangerous treasure discarded like a toy. The elderglass that mortared its stones rendered it proof against all human arts, much like the 5 towers and a dozen other structures scattered over the islands of the city. The men and women who lived in these places were squatters in glory, and the House of Glass Roses was the most glorious, dangerous place on the Alchigrante slopes. That Don Maranzala held it was a sign of his high and lasting favour with the Duke. Just before the midpoint of the noon hour the next day, Jean Tannen stood at the door of Don Maranzala's tower. 5 cylindrical stories of grey stone and silver glass, a hulking fastness that made the lovely villas around it look like an architect's scale models. Great waves of white heat beat down from the cloudless sky, and the air was heavy with the slightly beery breath of a city river boiling under long hours of sun. A frosted glass window was set into the stone beside the tower's huge lacquered oaken doors, behind which the vague outline of a face could be discerned. Jean's approach had been noted. He'd gone north over the Angevine on a glass catbridge no wider than his hips, clinging to the guide ropes with sweaty hands for all 600 feet of the crossing. There were no large bridges to the south bank of the Isla Zantara, second most easterly of the Alchigrante Islands. Ferry rides were a copper half-baron. For those too poor to ride, that left the ecstatic terror of the cat bridges. Jean had never been aloft on one before, and the sight of more experienced men and women ignoring the ropes as they crossed at speed had turned his bowels to ice water. The feel of hard pavement beneath his shoes had been a blessed relief when it came again. The sweat-soaked yellow jackets on duty at the Isla Zantara gatehouse had let Jean pass far more quickly than he'd thought possible, and he'd seen the mirth drain from their ruddy faces the moment they recognized the sigil he carried. Their directions after that had been terse. Was it pity that tinged their voices,
or fear.
"We'll look for you, boy,"
one of them suddenly called after him as he started up the clean white stones of the street,
"if you come back down the hill again."
Mingled pity and fear, then. Had Jean really been enthusiastic for this adventure as recently as the night before? The creak and rattle of counterweights heralded the appearance of a dark crack between the twin doors before him. A second later, the portal swung wide with slow majesty, muscled outward by a pair of men in blood-red waistcoats and sashes, and Jean saw that each door was half a foot of solid wood backed with iron bands. A wave of scents washed out over him, humid stone and old sweat, roasting meat and cinnamon incense, smells of prosperity and security, of life within walls. Jean held his wallet up to the men who'd opened the door, and one of them waved a hand impatiently.
"You're expected. Enter as a guest of Don Maranzala and respect his house as you would your own."
Against the left-hand wall of the opulent foyer, a pair of curlicue staircases in black iron wound upward. Jean followed the man around and up one set of narrow steps, self-consciously trying to keep his sweating and gasping under control. The tower doors were pulled shut beneath them with an echoing slam. They wound their way up past three floors of glittering glass and ancient stone, decorated with thick red carpets and innumerable stained tapestries that Jean recognized as battle flags. Don Maranzala had served as the Duke's personal sword master and the commander of his black jackets for a quarter of a century. These bloody scraps of cloth were all that remained of countless companies of men fated thrown against Nicovante and Maranzala in fights that were now legend. The Iron Sea Wars, the Mad Count's Rebellion, the Thousand-Day War against Tal Verar. At last, the winding stair brought them up into a small, dim room, barely larger than a closet, lit by the gentle red glow of a paper lantern. The man placed one hand on a brass knob and turned to look down at Jean.
"This is the garden without fragrance," he said. "Step with care and touch nothing as you love life."
Then he pushed the door to the roof open, letting in a sight so bright and astounding that Jean rocked backward on his heels. The house of glass roses was more than twice as wide as it was tall, so the roof must have been at least 100 feet in diameter, walled in on all sides. For a frightful moment, Jean thought he stood before a blazing 100-hued alchemical fire. All the stories and rumors had done nothing to prepare him for the sight of this place beneath the full light of a white summer sun. It seemed as though liquid diamond pulsed through a million delicate veins and scintillated on a million facets and edges. Here was an entire rose garden, wall after wall of perfect petals and stems and thorns, silent and scentless and alive with reflected fire, for it was all carved from elderglass, 100,000 blossoms perfect down to the tiniest thorn. Dazzled, Jean stumbled forward and stretched out a hand to steady himself. When he forced his eyes closed, the darkness was alive with afterimages like flashes of heat lightning. Don Maranzala's man caught him by the shoulders, gently but firmly.
"It can be overwhelming at first. Your eyes will adjust in a few moments. But mark my words well, and by the gods, touch nothing."
As Jean's eyes recovered from the initial shock of the garden, he began to see past the dazzling glare. Each wall of roses was actually transparent. The nearest was just 2 paces away, and it was flawless as the rumors claimed, as though the Eldrin had frozen every blossom and every bush in an instant of summer's fullest perfection. Yet there were patches of genuine color here and there in the hearts of the sculptures, swirled masses of reddish-brown translucence, like clouds of rust-colored smoke frozen in ice. These clouds of color were human blood. Every petal, leaf, and thorn was sharper than any razor. The merest touch would open human skin like paper, and the roses would drink, or so the stories said, siphoning blood deep inside the network of glass stems and vines.
Presumably, if enough lives were fed to the garden, every blossom and every wall would some day turn a rich, rusty red. Some rumours had it that the garden merely drank what was spilled upon it. Others claimed that the roses would actually draw blood forth from a wound, and could drain a man white from any cut, no matter how small. It would take intense concentration to walk through these paths. Most were only 2 or 3 paces wide, and a moment of distraction could be deadly. It said much about Don Maranzala that he thought of his garden as the ideal place to teach young men how to fight. For the first time, Jean felt a sense of dreadful awe at the creatures who'd vanished from Camorre 1,000 years before his birth. How many other alien surprises had they left behind for men to stumble over? What could drive away beings powerful enough to craft something like this? The answer did not bear thinking of. Maranzala's man released his grip on Jean's shoulders and re-entered the dim room at the apex of the stairs. The room, as Jean now saw, jutted out of the tower's wall like a gardener's shack. "The Don will be waiting at the center of the garden," he said. Then he pulled the door shut after him, and Jean seemed alone on the roof, with the naked sun overhead and the walls of thirsty glass before him. Yet he wasn't alone. There was noise coming from the heart of the glass garden, the wickering skirl of steel against steel, low grunts of exertion, a few terse commands and a deep voice rich with authority. Just a few minutes earlier, Jean would have sworn that the Catbridge crossing was the most frightening thing he'd ever done, but now that he faced the garden without fragrance, he would have gladly gone back to the midpoint of that slender arch 50 feet above the Angevine and danced on it without guide ropes. Still, the black wallet clutched in his right hand drew his mind to the fact that Father Chains had thought him right for whatever awaited him in this garden. Despite their scintillating danger, the roses were inanimate and unthinking. How could he have the heart of a killer if he feared to walk among them? Shame drove him forward, step by sliding step, and he threaded the twisting paths of the garden with exquisite care, sweat sliding down his face and stinging his eyes. "I am a gentleman bastard," he muttered to himself. It was the longest 30 feet of his brief life, that passage between the cold and waiting walls of roses. He didn't allow them a single taste of him. At the center of the garden was a circular courtyard about 30 feet wide. Here, 2 boys, roughly Jean's age, were circling one another, rapiers flicking and darting. Another 6 boys watched uneasily, along with a tall man of late middle age. This man had shoulder-length hair and drooping moustaches the color of cold campfire ashes. His face was like sanded leather, and though he wore a gentleman's doublet in the same vivid red as the attendants downstairs, he wore it over weather-stained soldier's breeches and tattered field boots. There wasn't a boy at the lesson who didn't put his master's clothes to shame. These were sons of the quality, in brocade jackets and tailored breeches, silk tunics and polished imitations of swordsmen's boots. Each one also wore a white leather buff coat and silver-studded bracers of the same material. Just the thing for warding off thrusts from training weapons. Jean felt naked the instant he stepped into the clearing, and only the threat of the glass roses kept him from leaping back into concealment. One of the duelists was surprised to see Jean emerge from the garden, and his opponent made good use of that split second of inattention. He deftly thrust his rapier into the meat of the first boy's upper arm, punching through the leather. The skewered boy let out an unbecoming holler and dropped his blade.
"My Lord Maranzala!"
One of the boys in the crowd spoke up, and there was more oil in his voice than there was on a blade put away for storage.
"Lorenzo was clearly distracted by the boy who just came out of the garden. That was not a fair strike."
Every boy in the clearing turned to regard Jean, and it was impossible to guess what soonest ignited their naked disdain. His labourer's clothing, his pear-like physique, his lack of weapons and armour. Only the boy with a spreading circle of blood on his tunic sleeve failed to stare at him with open loathing. He had other problems.
The grey-haired man cleared his throat, then spoke in the deep voice Jean had heard earlier. He seemed amused.
"You were a fool to take your eyes from your opponent, Lorenzo. So in a sense you earned that sting. But it is true, all things being equal, that a young gentleman should not exploit an outside distraction to score a touch. You will both try to do better next time."
He pointed toward Jean without looking at him, and his voice lost its warmth.
"And you, boy, lose yourself in the garden until we've finished here. I don't want to see you again until these young gentlemen have left."
Certain that the fire rising in his cheeks could outshine the sun itself, Jean rapidly scuttled out of sight. Several seconds passed before he realized with horror that he had leapt back into the maze of sculpted glass walls without hesitation. Positioning himself a few bends back from the clearing, he stood in mingled fear and self-loathing, and tried to hold himself rigid as the sun's heat cooked great rivers of sweat out of him. Fortunately, he hadn't much longer to wait. The sound of steel on steel faded, and Don Maranzalla dismissed his class. They filed past Jean with their coats off and their jackets open, each boy seemingly at ease with the lethal labyrinth of transparent blossoms. Not one said anything to Jean, for this was Don Maranzala's house, and it would be presumptuous of them to chastise a commoner within his domain. The fact that each boy had sweated his silk tunic to near translucency, and that several were red-faced and wobbly with sunsickness, did little to leaven Jean's misery.
"Boy!"
called the Don after the troop of young gentlemen had passed out of the garden and down the stairs.
"Attend me now!"
Summoning as much dignity as he could, and realizing that most of it was pure imagination, Jean sucked in his wobbling belly and went out into the courtyard once again. Don Maranzalla wasn't facing him. The Don held the undersized training rapier that had recently stung a careless boy's biceps. In his hands it looked like a toy, but the blood that glistened on its tip was quite real.
I'm sorry, sir, my lord Maranzalla. I must have come early. I didn't mean to distract from the lesson."
The Don turned on his heel, smooth as Talvera clockwork, every muscle in his upper body ominously statue still. He stared down at Jean now, and the cold scrutiny of those black, squinting eyes gave Jean the third great scare of the afternoon. He suddenly remembered that he was alone on the roof with a man that had butchered his way into the position he currently held.
"Does it amuse you, lowborn?" the Don asked in a serpentine whisper. "To speak before you are spoken to, in a place such as this, to a man such as myself, to a Don?"
Jean's blubbered apology died in his throat with an unmanly choke, the sort of wet noise a clam might make if you broke its shell and squeezed it out through the cracks.
"Because if you're being merely careless, I'll beat that habit out of your butterfat ass before you can blink."
The Don strode over to the nearest wall of glass roses, and with evident care slid the tip of the bloodied rapier into one of the blossoms. Jean watched in horrified fascination as the red stain quickly vanished from the blade and was drawn into the glass, where it diffused into a mist-like pink tendril and was carried into the heart of the sculpture. The Don tossed the clean sword to the ground.
"Is that it? Are you a careless little fat boy sent up here to pretend at arms? You're a dirty little urchin from the cauldron, no doubt. Some whore's god's damned droppings."
At first the paralysis of Jean's tongue refused to lift. Then he heard the blood pounding in his ears like the crashing of waves on a shore. His fists clenched on some impulse of their own.
"I was born in the north corner," he yelled, "and my mother and father were folk of business."
Almost as soon as he'd finished spitting this out, his heart seemed to stop. Mortified, he put his arms behind his back, bowed his head, and took a step backward.
After a moment of weighted silence, Maranzala laughed loudly and cracked his knuckles with a sound like pine logs popping in a fire.
"You must forgive me, Jean," he said. "I wanted to see if Chains was telling the truth. By the gods, you do have balls and a temper."
"You..."
Jean stared at the Don, comprehension dawning. "You wanted to make me angry, my lord?"
"I know you're sensitive about your parents, boy. Chains told me quite a bit about you."
The Don knelt on one knee before Jean, bringing them eye to eye, and put a hand on Jean's shoulder.
"Chains isn't blind," said Jean. "I'm not an initiate, and you're not really... not really..."
"A mean son of a bitch."
Jean giggled despite himself.
I wonder if I'll ever meet anyone who is what they seem to be ever again, my lord."
"You have. They walked out of my garden a few minutes ago. And I am a mean son of a bitch, Jean. You're going to hate my miserable old guts before this summer's out. You're going to curse me at false light and curse me at dawn."
"Oh," said Jean, "but that's just business."
"Very true," said Don Maranzala. "You know, I wasn't born to this place. It was a gift for services rendered. And don't think that I don't value it, but my mother and father weren't even from the North Corner. I was actually born on a farm."
"Wow," said Jean.
"Yes. Up here in this garden, it won't matter who your parents were. I'll make you work until you sweat blood and plead for mercy. I'll thrash on you until you're inventing new gods to pray to. The only thing this garden respects is concentration. Can you concentrate every moment you're up here? Can you distill your attention, drive it down to the narrowest focus, live absolutely in the now and shut out all other concerns?"
I shall have to try, my lord. I already walked through the gardens once. I can do it again."
"You will do it again. You'll do it 1,000 times. You'll run through my roses. You'll sleep among them. And you'll learn to concentrate. I warn you, though, some men could not."
The Don arose and swept a hand in a semicircle before him.
"You can find what they left behind here and there, in the glass."
Jean swallowed nervously and nodded.
"Now, you tried to apologize before for coming early. Truth is, you didn't. I let my previous lesson run long because I tend to indulge those wretched little shits when they want to cut each other up a bit. In future, come at the stroke of 1 to make sure they're long gone. They cannot be allowed to see me teaching you."
Once, Jean had been the son of substantial wealth, and he had worn clothes as fine as any just seen on this rooftop. What he felt now was the old sting of his loss, he told himself, and not mere shame for anything as stupid as his hair or his clothes or even his hanging belly. This thought was just self-importantly noble enough to keep his eyes dry and his face composed.
"I understand, my lord. I don't wish to embarrass you again."
"Embarrass me? Jean, you misunderstand."
Maranzala kicked idly at the toy rapier, and it clattered across the tiles of the rooftop.
"Those prancing little pants-wetters come here to learn the colourful and gentlemanly art of fencing, with its many sporting limitations and its prescriptions against dishonourable engagements. You, on the other hand," he said as he turned to give Jean a firm but friendly poke in the centre of his forehead, "you are going to learn how to kill men with a sword."
Chapter 7. Out the Window. 1. Locke outlined his plan over a long, nervous lunch. The gentleman bastards sat at the dining table in their glass burrow, just after noon on Duke's Day. Outside, the sun was pouring down its usual afternoon punishment, but in the burrow it was cool, perhaps unnaturally so,
even for an underground cellar. Chains had often speculated that the Elderglass did tricks with more than just light. They had laid on a feast more befitting a festival than a midday meeting. There was stewed mutton with onions and ginger, stuffed eels in spiced wine sauce, and green apple tarts baked by Jean, with a liberal dose of Osterschalen brandy poured over the fruit. "I'll bet even the Duke's own cook would have his balls skinned if he did this," he'd said. "Makes each tart worth 2 or 3 crowns, by my reckoning."
"What'll they be worth," said Bug, "once they're eaten and they come out the other end?"
"You're welcome to take measurements," said Carlo. "Grab a scale."
"And a scoop," added Galdo.
The Sanzas spent the meal picking at a seasoned omelette topped with minced sheep's kidneys, usually a favourite with the whole table. But today, though they all agreed it was their best effort in weeks, topping even the celebration of their first success in the Salvara game, the savour seemed to have evaporated. Only Bug ate with real vigour, and his attention was largely concentrated on Jean's plate of tarts.
"Look at me," he said with his mouth half full. "I'm worth more with every bite."
Quiet half-smiles met his clowning, and nothing more. The boy harrumphed in annoyance and banged his fists on the table.
"Well, if none of you want to eat," he said, "why don't we get on with planning how we're going to dodge the axe tonight?"
"Indeed," said Jean.
"Too right," added Carlo.
"Yes," said Galdo. "What's the game and how do we play it?"
"Well," Locke pushed his plate away, crumpled his cloth napkin, and threw it into the centre of the table.
"For starters, we need to use the damn broken tower rooms again. It seems the stairs aren't through with us just yet."
Jean nodded. "What will we do with the place?"
"That's where you and I will be when Andres comes looking to collect us at the 9th hour. And that's where we'll stay after he's thoroughly convinced that we have a very honest reason for not going with him."
"What reason would that be?" asked Carlo.
"A very colourful one," said Locke. "I need you and Galdo to pay a quick visit to Jessaline Dorbar this afternoon. I need help from a black alchemist for this. Here's what you tell her."
2. The illicit apothecary shop of Jessaline Dorbar and her daughter Janelaine was located above a scribe's collective in the respectable Fountain Bend neighbourhood. Carlo and Galdo stepped onto the scribing floor at just past the 2nd hour of the afternoon. Here a dozen men and women were hunched over wide wooden boards, working quills and salt and charcoal sticks, and drying sponges back and forth like automatons. A clever arrangement of mirrors and skylights let the natural light of day in to illuminate their work. There were few tradesfolk in Camor more penny-conscious than journeyman scriveners. At the rear of the first floor was a winding staircase, guarded by a tough-looking young woman who feigned boredom while fingering weapons beneath her brocaded brown coat. The Sansa twins established their bona fides with the combination of hand gestures and copper barons that made their way into the young woman's coat pockets. She tugged on a bell rope beside the stairs, then waved them up. On the second floor there was a reception room, windowless, walls and floor alike panelled with a golden hardwood that retained a faint aroma of pine lacquer. A tall counter divided the room precisely in half. There were no chairs on the customer side, and nothing at all on display on the merchant's side, just a single locked door.
Jessaline stood behind the counter, a striking woman in her mid-50s, with a tumbling cascade of charcoal-coloured hair and dark, wary eyes nestled in laugh lines. Janelaine, half her age, stood to her mother's right with a crossbow pointed just over Carlo and Galdo's heads. It was an indoor murder piece, lightweight and low power, which almost certainly meant some hideous poison on the quarrel. Neither Sansa was particularly bothered. This was business as usual for a black alchemist.
"Madame Dobar and Miss Dobar," said Carlo, bowing from the waist, "your servants." "Not to mention," said Galdo, "still very much available."
"Master Sansa and Master Sansa," said the elder Dobar, "pleased to see you." "Although we are," said Jeanne-Hélène, still very much disinclined.
"Perhaps you'd care to buy something, though?"
Jessalyn folded her hands on the counter and raised one eyebrow.
"As it happens, a friend of ours needs something special."
Carlo fished a coin purse from under his waistcoat and held it in plain view without opening it.
"Special?"
"Or perhaps not so much special as specific. He's got to get sick. Very sick."
"Far be it from me to drive away business, my dears," said the elder Dobar. "But 3 or 4 bottles of rum would do the trick at a fraction of the price for anything I could give you."
"Ah, not that sort of sick," said Galdo. "He's got to be in a bad way, like to knocking on Death Goddess' bedchamber and asking if he can come in. And then he's got to be able to recover his strength after playing ill for a while. A sort of mummer's sick, if you will."
"Hmm," said Jeanne-Hélène. "I don't know if we have anything that works quite like that, at least not on hand."
"When," said Jessalyn, "would your friend require a solution by?"
"We were sort of hoping to walk out of here with one," said Carlo.
"We don't brew miracles, my dears."
Jessalyn drummed her fingers on her countertop.
"Contrary to all common belief, we do prefer a bit of notice for something like this. Messing about with someone's inside, fit to ill and then fit again in the span of a few hours, well, that's delicate."
"We're not bonds, Magi," added Jeanne-Hélène.
"Praise the gods for that," said Galdo, "but it's very pressing."
"Well," sighed Jessalyn, "perhaps we can bang something together. A bit on the crude, but it might do the trick."
"Barrel robber's blossom," said her daughter.
"Yes," Jessalyn nodded, "and somne pine after."
"I believe we've both in the shop," Jeanne-Hélène said. "Shall I check?"
"Do, and hand over that alley piece while you're back there."
Jeanne-Hélène passed the crossbow to her mother, then unlocked the door at the rear of the room and disappeared, closing it behind her once again. Jessalyn set the weapon gently down atop the counter, keeping one long-fingered hand on the tiller.
"You wound us, madam," said Carlo. "We're harmless as kittens."
"More so," said Galdo. "Kittens have claws and piss on things indiscriminately."
"It's not just you, boys. It's the city. Whole place is like the boil, what with Nazca getting clipped. Old Barsavi's got to have some retribution in the works. God knows who this Grey King is or what he wants, but I'm more worried by the day for what might come up my stairs."
"It's a messy time," said Carlo.
Jeanne-Hélène returned with 2 small pouches in her hands. She locked the door behind her, passed the pouches to her mother, and picked up the crossbow once again.
"Well," said the elder Dobar, "here's what it is, then. Your friend takes this, the red pouch. It's barrel robber's blossom, a sort of purple powder. In the red pouch, remember. Put it in water. It's an emetic, if the word means anything to you."
"Nothing pleasant," said Galdo.
5 minutes after he drinks it, he gets an ache in the belly. 10 minutes, and he gets wobbly at the knees. 15 minutes, and he starts vomiting up every meal he's had for the past week. Won't be pretty. Have buckets close at hand."
"And it'll look absolutely real?" asked Carlo.
"Look? Sweetmeat, it'll be as real as it gets. You ever see anyone feign vomiting?"
"Yes," said the Sansas in perfect unison. "He does this thing with chewed-up oranges," added Galdo.
"Well, your friend won't be feigning this. Any physicker in Camor would swear it was a real and natural distress. You can't even see the barrel robber's blossom once it comes up. It dissolves quickly."
"And then," said Carlo, "what about the other pouch?"
"This is somne pine bark. Crumble it and steep it in a tea. It's the perfect counter for the purple blossom. It'll cancel it right out. But the blossom will already have done its work. Keep that in mind. The bark won't put food back in his belly, or give back the vigor he loses while he's retching his guts out.
He's going to be weak and sore for at least an evening or two.
Sounds wonderful, said Carlo. By our own peculiar definition of wonderful, what do we owe you?
3 crowns 20 solons, said Jessalyn. And that's only because you were old chains boys. This isn't much by way of alchemy, just refined and purified, but the powders are hard to get hold of.
Carlo counted out 20 gold tyrins from his purse and set them atop the counter in a vertical stack.
Here's 5 crowns, then, with the understanding that this transaction is best forgotten by everyone involved.
Sansa, said Jessalyn Dobar without humour, every purchase at my shop is forgotten, as far as the outside world is concerned.
Then this one, said Carlo, adding 4 more tyrins to the pile, needs to stay extra forgotten.
Well, if you really want to reinforce the point.
She pulled a wooden scraper from beneath the counter and used it to pull the coins over the back edge into what sounded like a leather bag. She was careful not to touch the coins themselves. Black alchemists rarely got to be her age if they relaxed their paranoia toward all things touched, tasted, or smelled.
You have our thanks, said Galdo, and that of our friend as well.
Oh, don't count on that, Jessalyn Dorbar chuckled. Give him the red pouch first, then see what a grateful frame of mind it puts him in.
3. Get me a glass of water, Jean. Locke stared out the canal-side window of the 7th-floor room as the buildings of southern Camor grew long black shadows toward the east.
It's time to take my medicine. I'm guessing it's close on 9:20.
Already set, said Jean, passing over a tin cup with a cloudy lavender residue swirling in it. That stuff did dissolve in a blink, just like the Sansa said.
Well, he said, here's to deep pockets poorly guarded. Here's to true alchemists, a strong stomach, a clumsy grey king, and the luck of the crooked warden.
Here's to living out the night, said Jean, miming the clink of a cup against Locke's own. Locke sipped hesitantly, then tilted the cup back and poured it down his throat in one smooth series of gulps.
Actually not bad at all. Tastes minty, very refreshing.
A worthy epitaph, said Jean, taking the cup. Locke stared out the window a while longer. The mesh was up, as the Duke's wind was still blowing in strongly from the sea, and the insects weren't yet biting. Across the Via Camarazza, the arsenal district was mostly silent and motionless. With the iron sea city-states at relative peace, all the great saw yards and warehouses and wet docks had little business. In a time of need, they could build or service 2 dozen ships at once. Now Locke could see only 1 skeletal hull rising within the yards. Beyond that, the sea broke white against the base of the South Needle, an elderglass-mortared stone breakwater nearly 3/4 of a mile in length. At its southernmost tip, a human-built watchtower stood out against the darkening sea. Beyond that, the white blurs of sails could be seen beneath the red tendrils of clouds in the sky.
"Oh," he said, "I do believe something's happening."
"Take a seat," said Jean. "You're supposed to get wobbly in just a bit."
"Already happening. In fact, gods, I think I'm going to..."
So it began. A great wave of nausea bubbled up in Locke's throat, and with it came everything he'd eaten for the past day. For a few long minutes he crouched on his knees, clutching a wooden bucket as devoutly as any man had ever prayed over an altar for intercession from the gods.
"Jean!"
he gasped out during a brief lull between spasms of retching.
"Next time I conceive a plan like this, consider planting a hatchet in my skull."
Hardly efficacious. Jean swapped a full bucket for an empty one and gave Locke a friendly pat on the back. "Dulling my nice sharp blades on a skull as thick as yours." One by one, Jean shuttered the windows. False light was just rising outside. "Ghastly as it is," he said, "we need the smell to make an impression when Andres shows up." Even once Locke's stomach was thoroughly emptied, The dry heaving continued. He shuddered and shook and moaned, clutching at his guts. Jean hauled him bodily over to a sleeping pallet, where he looked down in genuine worry. "You're pale and clammy," he muttered. "Not bad at all. Very realistic."
"Pretty, isn't it? Gods!" whispered Locke. "How much longer?"
"Can't rightly say," said Jean. "They should be arriving down there right about now. Give them a few minutes to get impatient with waiting around for us and come storming up here."
During those few minutes, Locke became intimately acquainted with the idea of a short eternity. Finally, there came the creak of footsteps on the stairs and a loud banging on the door.
"La Mora!" Angers Barsavi's voice. "Tannen, open up or I'll kick the damn door in!"
"Thank the gods!"
croaked Locke as Jean rose to unbolt the door.
"We've been waiting out front of the last mistake. Are you coming or... Gods, what the hell happened in here?"
Angers threw one arm up over his face as he stepped into the apartment and the smell of sickness. Jean pointed to Locke, writhing on the bed, moaning, half wrapped in a thin blanket despite the moist heat of the evening.
"He took ill just half an hour ago, maybe," said Jean, "losing his stomach all over the damn place. I don't know what's the matter."
"Gods, he's turning green!"
Angers took a few steps closer to Locke, staring in horrified sympathy. He was dressed for a fight, with a boiled leather cuirass, an unbuckled leather collar, and a pair of studded leather braces tied over his ham-like forearms. Several men had accompanied him up the stairs, but none of them seemed in any hurry to follow him into the rooms.
"I had capon for lunch," said Jean, "and he had fish rolls. That's the last thing either of us ate, and I'm fine."
"Yono's piss. Fish rolls. Fresher than he bargained for, I'd wager."
"Angers,"
Locke croaked, reaching out toward him with a shaking hand.
Don't leave me. I can still go. I can still fight."
"Gods, no." Angers shook his head emphatically. "You're in a bad way, La Mora. I think you'd best see a physica. Have you summoned one, Tannen?"
"I haven't had a chance. I fetched out the buckets and I've been looking after him since it started."
"Well, keep it up. Both of you stay. No, don't get angry, Jean. He clearly can't be left on his own. Stay and tend him. Fetch a physica when you can."
Angers gave Locke two brief pats on his exposed shoulder.
"We'll get the fucker tonight, Locke. No worries. We'll do him for good, and I'll send someone to look in on you when we're done. I'll square this with Papa. He'll understand."
"Please, please, Jean can help me stand. I can still..."
"End of discussion. You can't fucking stand up. You're sick as a fish dropped in a wine bottle."
Angers backed toward the door and gave Locke a brief sympathetic wave before he ducked out.
"If I get my hands on the bastard personally, I'll deck him once for you, Locke. Rest easy."
Then the door slammed, and Locke and Jean were alone once again. 4. Long minutes passed. Jean unshuttered the canal side window and stared out into the glimmer of false light. He watched as Angers and his men broke loose from the crowds below, then hurried across a Via Camarazza cat bridge and into the arsenal district. Angers didn't look back even once, and soon enough he was swallowed up by shadows and distance.
"Long gone.
Can I help you out of..." Jean said, turning away from the window. Locke had already stumbled out of bed and was splashing water on the alchemical hearthstone, looking 10 years older and 20 pounds thinner. That was alarming. Locke didn't have 20 pounds to spare.
"Lovely. The least complicated, least important job of the night is done. Carry on, gentlemen bastards," said Locke.
His face was alight in the reflected glow of the simmering stone as he set a glazed jug of water atop it. 10 years older? More like 20.
"Now for the tea, gods bless it, and it had better be as good as the purple powder."
Jean grimaced and grabbed the two vomit buckets Locke had used, then moved back to the window. False light was dying down now. The hangman's wind was blowing up warm and strong, bringing a low ceiling of dark clouds with it, visible just past the five towers. The moons would be swallowed by those clouds tonight, at least for a few hours. Pinpricks of firelight were appearing across the city as though an unseen jeweller was setting his wares out on a field of black cloth. "Jessalyn's little potion seems to have brought up every meal I've had in the past 5 years," said Locke. "Nothing left to spit up but my naked soul. Make sure it isn't floating around in one of those before you toss them, right?" His hands shook as he crumbled the dry Somne pine bark right into the jug of water. He didn't feel like messing about with proper tea brewing. "I think I see it," Jean said. "Nasty, crooked little thing it is, too. You're better off with it floating out to sea." Jean took a quick glance out the window to ensure that there were no canal boats drifting below in the path of a truly foul surprise, then simply flung the buckets one after the other. They hit the grey water 70-odd feet below with loud splashes, but Jean was certain nobody noticed or cared. Komori were always throwing disgusting things into the Via Camarazza. Satisfied with his aim, Jean then slid the hidden closet open and pulled out their disguises, cheap traveller's cloaks and a pair of broad-brimmed Talvarar caps fashioned from some ignoble leather with the greasy texture of sausage casings. He flung one brownish-grey cloak over Locke's shoulders. Locke clutched at it gratefully and shivered. "You've got that motherly concern in your eyes, Jean. I must look like hammered shit." "Actually, you look like you were executed last week. I hate to ask, but are you sure you're going to be up for this?" "Whatever I am, it has to be sufficient." Locke wrapped one end of his cloak around his right hand and picked up the jug of half-boiled tea. He sipped and swallowed, bark and all, reasoning that the best place for the stuff would be his empty stomach. "Ugh! It tastes like a kick in the gut feels. Have I pissed Jessalyn off recently, too?" His expression was picturesque, as though the skin of his face were trying to peel itself back and leap off his bones. But he continued to choke the near tea down anyway. Jean steadied him by placing both hands on his shoulders, privately afraid that another bout of vomiting might be more than Locke could handle. After a few minutes, Locke set the empty jug down and sighed deeply. "I can't wait to have words with the Grey King when this shit is all finished," Locke whispered. "There's a few things I want to ask him. Philosophical questions, like, how does it feel to be dangled out a window by a rope tied around your balls, motherfucker?"
"Sounds more like physic than philosophy. But as you said, we have to wait for the falconer to leave first."
Jean's voice was steady and totally empty of emotion, the voice he always used when discussing a plan only loosely tethered to prudence and sanity. "Pity we can't just blindside the bastard from an alley."
"Couldn't give him so much as a second to think, or we'd lose."
"Anything less than 20 yards, mused Jean. "One good throw with a wicked sister. Wouldn't take but half a second."
"But you and I both know," Locke replied slowly, "that we can't kill a bondsmage. We wouldn't live out the week. Carthane would make examples of us, plus Carlo, Galdo, and Bug as well. Not very clever at all, that way out. A drawn-out suicide."
Locke stared down at the fading glow of the hearthstone and rubbed his hands together. "I wonder, Jean, I really wonder, is this what other people feel like when we're through with them? After we get the goods and pull the vanish and there's nothing they can do about it?" The light from the hearthstone sank several stages further before Jean answered.
"I thought we'd agreed long ago that they get what they deserve, Locke. Nothing more. This is a fantastically silly moment to start giving a shit."
"Giving a shit?" Locke started, blinking as though he had just woken up. "No, don't get me wrong. It's just this sewn-up feeling. No way out is for other people, not for the gentleman bastards. I don't like being trapped."
At a sudden gesture from Locke, Jean pulled him to his feet. Jean wasn't sure if the tea was any more responsible than the cloak, but Locke was no longer shivering.
"Too right," Locke continued, his voice gaining strength. "Too right, I don't like it. Let's get this shit job over with.
We can have a good ponder on the subject of our favourite grey ratfucker and his pet mage after I've danced to their little tune." Jean grinned and cracked his knuckles, then ran a hand down the small of his back, the old familiar gesture, making sure that the wicked sisters were ready for a night out. "You sure," he said, "that you're ready for the Vine Highway?" "Ready as I can be, Jean. Hell, I weigh considerably less than I did before I drank that potion. Climbing down will be the easiest thing I do all night." 5. The trellis ran up the full height of the broken tower on the westward face of the structure, overlooking a narrow alley. The lattice of wood was threaded with tough old vines and built around the windows on each floor. Though something of a bitch to climb, it was the perfect way to avoid the few dozen familiar faces that were sure to be in the last mistake on any given night. The gentleman bastards used the Vine Highway frequently. The alley-side shutters banged open on the top floor of the broken tower. All the light inside Locke and Jean's suite of rooms had been extinguished. A large, dark shape slid out into the mass of trellised vines, and was shortly followed by a smaller shape. Clinging with white-knuckled determination, Locke gently eased the shutters closed above him, then willed his queasy stomach to quit complaining for the duration of the climb. The hangman's wind, on its way out to the salty blackness of the iron sea, caught at his cap and cloak with invisible fingers that smelled of marshes and farmers' fields. Jean kept himself 2 or 3 feet under Locke, and they descended steadily, one foothold or handhold at a time. The windows on the 6th floor were shuttered and dark. Thin slivers of amber light could be seen around the shutters on the 5th floor. Both climbers slowed without the need for words and willed themselves to be as quiet as possible, to be patches of grey invisible against deeper darkness, nothing more. They continued down. The 5th floor shutters flew outward as Jean was abreast with them on their left. One hinged panel rebounded off his back, almost startling him out of his hold on the trellis. He curled his fingers tightly around wood and vine and looked to his right. Locke stepped on his head in surprise, but quickly pulled himself back up.
"I know there's no other way out, you miserable bitch!" hissed a man's voice.
There was a loud thump, and then a shudder ran up and down the trellis. Someone else had just gone out the window and was scrabbling in the vines beside and just below them. A black-haired woman stuck her head out of the window, intent on yelling something in return, but when she caught sight of Jean through the cracks in her swinging shutter, she gasped. This in turn drew the attention of the man clinging just beneath her, a larger man even than Jean.
"What the hell is this shit?" he gasped. "What are you doing outside this window?"
"Amusing the gods, asshole." Jean kicked down and tried to nudge the newcomer further down the trellis, to no avail. "Kindly heave yourself down."
"What are you doing outside this window, huh? You like to sneak a peek? You can sneak a peek of my fist, cocksucker!"
Grunting with exertion, he began to climb back upward, grabbing at Jean's legs. Jean narrowly yanked himself out of the way, and the world reeled around him as he regained his balance. Black wall, black sky, wet black cobblestones 50 feet below. That was a bad fall, the kind that cracked men like eggs.
"All of you, get off my damned window now! Ferens, for Morganti's sake, leave them be and get down!"
the woman hollered.
"Shit!"
Locke muttered from a few feet above and to her left, his eloquence temporarily cowed into submission.
"Madam, you're complicating our night, so before we come in and complicate yours, kindly cork your bullshit bottle and close the goddamned window."
She looked up aghast.
"Two of you? All of you, get down! Get down! Get down! Close your window! Close your window! Close your fucking window!" "I'll kill both you shit-suckers!"
huffed Ferenz.
"Drop you both off this fucking..."
There was a marrow-chillingly loud cracking noise, and the trellis shuddered beneath the hands of the three men clinging to it.
"Ah," said Locke. "Ah, that figures. Thanks ever so much, Ferenz."
Then there was a torrent of polysyllabic blasphemy from four mouths.
Exactly who said what would never be clearly recalled. Two careful men were apparently the trellis limit. Under the weight of three careless flailers, it began to tear free of the stone wall with a series of creaks and pops. Ferren surrendered to gravity and common sense and began sliding downward at prodigious speed, burning his hands as he went, all but peeling the trellis off the wall above him. It finally gave way when he was about 20 feet above the ground, flipping over and dashing him down into the darkened alley, where he was promptly covered in falling vines and wood. His descent had snapped off a section of trellis at least 30 feet long, starting just beneath Jean's dangling feet. Wasting no time, Locke shimmied to his right and dropped down onto the window ledge, shoving the screaming woman back with the tip of one boot. Jean scrambled upward, for the shutter still blocked his direct access to the window, and as the section of trellis under his hands began to pull out of the wall, he gracelessly swung himself over the shutter and in through the window, taking Locke with him. They wound up in a heap on the hardwood floor, tangled in cloaks.
"Get back out the fucking window now!"
the woman screamed, punctuating each word with a swift kick to Jean's back and ribs. Fortunately, she wasn't wearing shoes.
"That would be stupid," Locke said, from somewhere under his larger friend.
"Hey!" Jean said.
"Hey! Hey!"
He caught the woman's foot and propelled her backward. She landed on her bed. It was the sort commonly called a dangler, a two-person hammock of strong but lightweight demi-silk, anchored to the ceiling at four points. She went sprawling across it, and both Locke and Jean suddenly noticed that she wasn't wearing anything but her small clothes. In the summer, a Komori woman's small clothes are small indeed.
"Out, you bastards! Out! Out! I..."
As Locke and Jean stumbled to their feet, the door on the wall opposite the window slammed open, and in stepped a broad-shouldered man with the slab-like muscles of a stevedore or a smith. Vengeful satisfaction gleamed in his eyes, and the smell of hard liquor rolled off him, sour and acute even from 10 paces away. Locke wasted half a second wondering how Ferenc had gotten back upstairs so quickly, and another half second realizing that the man in the doorway wasn't Ferenc. He giggled, briefly but uncontrollably. The night wind slammed the shutter against the open window behind him. The woman made a noise somewhere in the back of her throat, a noise not unlike a cat falling down a deep, dark well.
"You filthy bitch,"
the man said, his speech a thick, slow drawl.
"Filthy, filthy bitch! I just knew it! Knew you weren't alone!"
He spat, then shook his head at Locke and Jean.
"Two guys at once, too. Damn. Go figure. Guess it takes that many to replace me. Hope you boys had yourselves a fun time with another man's woman,"
he continued, drawing 9 inches of blackened steel stiletto from his left boot.
"'Cause now I'm gonna make you women."
Jean spread his feet and moved his left hand under his cloak, ready to draw the sisters. With his right hand, he nudged Locke a pace behind him.
"Hold it!" Locke cried, waving both of his hands. "I know what this looks like, but you've got the wrong idea, friend." He pointed at the petrified woman clinging to the hanging bed. "She came before we came."
"Gethys!"
hissed the woman.
"Gethys, these men attack me! Get them! Save me!"
Gethys charged at Jean, growling. He held his knife out before him in the grip of an experienced fighter, but he was still drunk and he was still angry. Locke dodged out of the way as Jean caught Gathis by his wrist, stepped inside his reach, and sent him sprawling to the floor with a quick sweep of the legs. There was an unappetizing snapping noise, and the blade fell from Gathis' grip. Jean had retained a firm hold on his wrist, and then twisted as the man went down on his back. For a moment Gathis was too bewildered to cry out, then the pain broke through to his dulled senses, and he roared. Jean hoisted him up off the ground with one quick yank by the front of his tunic, and then he shoved Gathis with all his might into the stone wall to the left of the window. The big man's head bounced off the hard surface, and he stumbled forward. The blurred arc of Jean's right fist met his jaw with a crack, abruptly cancelling his forward momentum.
He flopped to the ground, boneless as a sack of dough.
"Yes!" cried the woman. "Now throw him out the window!"
"For the love of the gods, madam," snapped Locke, "can you please pick one man in your bedroom to cheer for and stick with him?" "If he's found dead in the alley beneath your window," said Jean, "I'll come back and give you the same." "And if you tell anyone that we came through here," added Locke, "you'll only wish he'd come back and given you the same."
"Gathis will remember," she screeched. "He'll certainly remember."
"A big man like him? Please." Jean made a show of arranging his cloak and redonning his hat. "He'll say it was 8 men and they all had clubs." Locke and Jean hurried out the door through which Gathis had entered, which led to the landing of the 5th-floor steps on the north side of the tower. With the trellis damaged, there was nothing else for it but to proceed quickly down on foot and pray to the crooked warden. Locke drew the door closed behind them, leaving the bewildered woman sprawled on her hanging bed, with the unconscious Gathis curled up beside her window. "The luck of the gods must certainly be with us," said Locke as they hurried down the creaking steps. "At least we didn't lose these stupid fucking hats." A small dark shape hissed past them, wings fluttering, a sleek shadow visible as it swooped between them and the lights of the city. "Well," Locke added, "for better or worse, from this point on, I suppose we're under the falconer's wing."